Meeting of the House and Senate Interim Judiciary Committees, June 7th, 2006, 9:00 a.m. at Umpqua Community College.
House Senate Judiciary Committees are to order.
House Interim Committee on Judiciary to order. Representative Hannah.
Good morning.
Would you like to introduce someone here for us?
I would like to do that. First of all, I want to welcome everyone to Central Douglas County, to the Roseburg area, and more specifically to Umpqua Community College. You are in House District 7, which happens to be my district. You're actually in my backyard. I get to count the community college as my neighbor, and for that I'm grateful, because as you can all see, it's a most beautiful campus. And I'm also an alumni of 2 years here at the community college, for which I'm also grateful for that part of public education, a beautiful place to do so. I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce Dr. Blaine Neeson, the president of the community college, and he'd just like to say hello and welcome you as well.
Thank you, Representative Hannah, distinguished chairs and representatives of the Judiciary Committee. It's a pleasure to welcome you here today. Indeed, this is a beautiful campus, a campus that we're very, very proud of. Umpqua Community College just celebrated its 40th anniversary last year, and during those 40 years, we've educated over 120,000 Douglas County residents. And we're very, very proud of the traditions that we have at this college. We're also excited about the future we have for this college. Through community partnerships, we've added 6 new instructional programs this year. And we're excited about those new instructional programs because they're all tied to economic development and getting people back to work. We have one of the highest unemployment rates in the state in Douglas County. I think it covers around 8%. And we have had 100% placement in our truck driving program. And all of those people exiting that program have all landed in jobs that begin at $35,000, $40,000 a year. So we're very, very pleased with our community partners who are making it possible for us to expand opportunities for the residents of Douglas County. I hope you have a very enjoyable meeting here today, and if there's anything I or my staff may do to make your stay more enjoyable, just let us know. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Might be interesting for our colleagues from up north, Senator Burdick. You're about 12 miles from my district, and actually I go clear to I-5, and a lot of people don't know that. Clear down to the Seven Feathers, but I've got everything that's on the west side where all the trees are. I don't have the people over here, but it's been good getting to be in this part of the state, and it took some time to do it after redistricting to understand where those lines and where those people's values were and the things that they're concerned about, so we're glad to be over here too. Okay, we'll go ahead and start off this morning.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before we go there, since we're not going to do the business office for the introductions, I also would like to welcome everyone to my Senate district, which is part of Bruce's.
It does happen to be here.
We're glad that everyone could come down and join us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Anyone else?
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Olson.
She's here.
Not oftentimes I get to chide someone for being late.
And then this is obvious.
Thank you.
We're going to start out with the first topic we have, boys and girls, and I'll be with Sue Porter, please. Come forward, please identify yourself.
Co-chairs and vice chairs, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Porter. I'm with the Office of Economic Analysis, part of the Department of Administrative Services, and I am here today to brief you on the causes for historical and projected prison population growth. And I brought some testimony. It has the BASS logo on it, and I'm going to go through that. Our office does these forecasts semi-annually. In April and October they're due, and the information I have today will be based on the April 2006 corrections population forecast. And to formulate these forecasts, we have an advisory committee to help us, and that includes, for example, our chair is Judge Franz from Multnomah County. We have DAs, assistant DAs, police administrators, the director of corrections. So we try and get a cross-section of the entire criminal justice system to help us set assumptions about the future. In my testimony on the first page, there's table one and figure one that show historical and projected prison population growth. Now the chart goes back to 1985, but I'm really going to be talking about the period from 1995 up until January of 2016, which is when our current forecast ends. And during that time, Oregon's prison population has grown by 75% since July of 1995 up until June of this year. June 1, the population was 13,188. So in contrast, for that's an 11-year period. For the next 9 years, we forecast 21% growth, which is still pretty high growth, but nothing like we have seen in the last 11 years. And you can see from the chart that the growth has started to, I mean, it's growth, but it's not as steep as it was in the early 90s. So I wanted to hopefully convey what are the causes of this growth. Now, the same causes that cause historical growth are the same things that are causing the future growth. And what I'm going to be talking about is bed impacts. And impacts are different from population. So if you see numbers in here, it'll say Measure 11 impact. If you were to look in our forecast and see Measure 11 population, there are two different numbers. So, for example, with Measure 11, we're just trying to get to the population that would not be in prison if it weren't for that law. Now, most of the people that commit crimes in the Measure 11 list went to prison before Measure 11, and you know they go to prison now. The difference is in how long they stay. So that's what we're trying to separate out. What is it? What's the impact of the law? So when I started doing this analysis, I just took the historical population and the forecast population. I started subtracting out policy impacts that I could identify to see what we would have. And I found five in all that were big enough that, you know, we could actually, you know, get our hands on. The five that I'm going to present are Measure 11, the repeat property offender law, felony assault 4, felony driving under the influence, and the expansion of the alternative incarceration program. Those five I subtracted from the current and or the historical and forecast population to see what I would get. Now there's one major impact I cannot account for, and that's Senate Bill 1145. I can't, you know, tell you what the population would be in the absence of that law. It was such a fundamental change, and that was the local control law that took people who had been felons sentenced to 12 months or less, took them out of the prison system and put them into the local supervisory authority. And that is so intertwined with the criminal justice system. For this presentation, just way too complicated to try and pull that out. So on page 2 of my testimony, I have what I term the baseline population, and that is what would the prison population have been if I took out all these policy impacts except for Senate Bill 1145. And that is shown in the chart and the table. The blue area is just the population with 1145 taken out. because they went out to the county. Then there's a little yellow layer on top of that, and that is what I'm calling the response to 1145. Now, right after 1145 became law, we had a growth in intakes of inmates where their sentence was 13 to 15 months. Prior to 1145, we would get about 50 a year. By 98, we're getting 300 intakes a year, and it's been about that way ever since. So these were probably people were theorizing that maybe would have got a 10-month sentence before 1145, and there's enough leeway in the guidelines that they can get that prison sentence and come to prison. So I figure if we have 1145 in our analysis, it's only fair to include this, you know, reaction to. So that's those two components together are there. That's what I'm calling the baseline population. Everything else being equal, taking out all these those five policies, here's what the population might have looked like. So in the table, there our actual population is there. The baseline population is taken out. So it would show as of January 1, 2006, that the total impact of all these policies is about 4,700 beds, and that the current population, or population as of January this year, might have been 8,246. So with that, I was going to go through those five impacts and show their relative contribution to that, to prison growth, and that starts on page 3. In the chart there, you have our baseline population in blue at the bottom, and then we're adding in policy impacts. The yellow area is measure 11, and on top of that, you have repeat property, and then the next three are tiny and hard to see. There's the felony drunken driving, felony assault 4, and the actual population is a dotted red line that is on top, and you can see if you have good eyes at the very, very end, our actual population is a little lower than the sum of all those four impacts, and that's because the alternative incarceration program was expanded, and that lowered the population. So there's a little marking for the alternative incarceration program at the end. And you can see that Measure 11 and repeat property really account for most of the growth in the prison population. And I was going to go through and just briefly try to explain how it is that they do that, starting with Measure 11. And first, there are some definitions to get out of the way. When I say a Measure 11 sentence, I mean somebody sentenced under ORS 137-700 with the mandatory minimum sentence. When I say Measure 11 crime, I'm talking about someone that's convicted of one of those crimes listed in that statute, but their crime predates the law, so they were sentenced under guidelines or under the parole system. And then finally, we have Measure 11 related. These are people who are convicted of a crime that's, you know, it's like a Measure 11 crime, but it's a degree removed or it's an attempt. For example, Assault 1 and Assault 2 are Measure 11 crimes with a mandatory minimum sentence. Attempted Assault 1 and Assault 3 are what we would call Measure 11 related. And the reason we started looking at Measure 11 related is before Measure 11, relatively few people came to prison with an Assault 3 conviction. Since then, you know, if we add up all the different, there's Robbery 3, attempted robberies, any way that you can just move out of Measure 11, just a shade out, the number of people that come to prison now is about four times the number that came to prison prior to the law. So those are the three groups that we will be talking about for Measure 11. And then we have direct and indirect impact. direct impact is going to be, we're talking about people that are actually sentenced under the statute with those mandatory minimum sentence. What is their impact on the prison system? And then the indirect impact is from that growth in what we call those Measure 11 related people. So on table 4, page 4, we have annual intakes for Measure 11 crimes and Measure 11 sentenced inmates. And you can see that after 95, when Measure 11 took effect, the number of intakes actually went down. And it averages about 700 a year. Has gone up and down over the years since Measure 11, but tends to hover around 700. So Measure 11, we're saying, as of January, had about a 3,000 bed impact on the prison system. How does it do it if intakes went down? And that's explained in Figure 4. It's all on the length of stay. That chart, it shows time along the horizontal axis. It's months since the inmate was admitted to prison. And the percentage along the vertical, that's the percentage of inmates that are still in prison so many months after they came in. The bottom line is those Measure 11 crime people, the people, you know, with a conviction for Assault 1, but it predates Measure 11. So the people that are sentenced mostly under guidelines. And if you look at the 50% mark, the halfway point, median, for those people, that was about 37 months. Now the top line, the red line, those are all people actually sentenced under Measure 11. The median there is 87 months, so we're talking about a 50-month difference in length of stay, or a little over 4 years. That's where the vast majority of impact from Measure 11 comes, and the vast majority of growth in the prison system. Now the indirect growth, again, is just from that increase in intakes for those Measure 11 related crimes. And if you go to page 5, there's a chart that is the historical and forecast combined impact of Measure 11, and that dark flat area at the bottom, that's the indirect impact. It's around 1100, doesn't grow a whole lot. So the growth there is in the direct impact from those longer sentences. And you can see from Table 5 that the growth rate has been declining, and it's pretty much on a kind of a smooth downward trajectory as far as growth rate. Still growth, but the rate is slowing. And also on in Figure 4, you might note that our time goes out to 120 months because we forecast 10 years. But you can see that those Measure 11 people, about a third of them or 30% of them, are still in prison after 10 years. So their impact, their growth, continues beyond 10 years. At some point, releases and intakes will equal, and I haven't gone out that far. We forecast that 10 years could be around 20 years when that would happen. But certainly the growth rate would continue to slow throughout that time. Now, the second driver of prison population growth is repeat property offenders. That's ORS 137717, and that was passed along with Senate Bill 1145 back in 96. And this is an example of why it's so hard to take 1145 out of this analysis, because so many of these laws were passed with 1145 in mind. So back before 1145, chronic property offenders, they went to prison and they would be in the guidelines maybe in the 10 to 12 month range, but With 1145 and our guidelines, if a person just continually did property crimes, never had a person crime, for a lot of them, they would never reach the 13-month point. So they would be now under local control. This repeat property offender law was passed along with 1145, and it gave a 13 or 19-month presumptive minimum sentence for property offenders that had a certain criminal history. And then along the way, there were more offenses created or added. So in 1999, the Legislative Assembly created the crime of identity theft and added it to the list. In 2001, forgery one was added to the list, and also aggravated theft, the sentence was increased from 13 to 19 months. So the impact from repeat property derives from intakes. Without repeat property on the books, and with 1145, we might have a population of about 200 of these kind of people where, you know, they could get a prison sentence. So with this, you can see in page 6, there's the impact of repeat property. It's been growing very, very steeply. You can see the growth rate in the population, historical and forecast in table 6, and then the historical growth rates in the last few years in table 7. Just incredible, unbelievable growth rates in the number of people coming to prison. Now, this has also had a lot to do with the growth in the female population, particularly forgery 1 and identity theft. Since 2003, about a third of the intakes where the major new conviction is for forgery 1 or identity theft. 30% of those are females, which is a very high participation rate for females. In comparison, 11% of all intakes are female. Back in the late 90s, about 9% were all female. So, and most of these females that come in with that crime are in the repeat property offender category. So, I think back right in 97, there was probably a couple hundred female inmates, and last winter we passed the 1,000 mark. And so it's just, I kind of think of it as a perfect storm. I mean, people were getting victimized by identity theft, it was made a crime, and then it's just become an ever more popular crime. Law enforcement's more aware of it, and people tend to do it in a spree over a period of time. So, you know, when they are apprehended, they've already got the criminal history there to send them to prison. So that those two laws are most of the growth in the prison population. And for both of them, we expect the rate of growth to decline in the future. And then just the final three, the felony assault for felony drunken driving and expanded AIP, those we don't expect, well, felony assault for, we have a figure there's an impact of about 160 beds. Drunken driving, about 220 beds. We don't expect those to grow or change significantly in the future. And then the alternative incarceration program, just the expansion of it, we figure that has a negative impact of about 220 beds. So at any given time, the population would be 200 beds higher were it not for that program. Table on page 7, table 8 and table 9 are kind of the counterparts to what was in the earlier part of the testimony about historical growth. And this is an estimate of these policy impacts on the future prison population. So in table 8, you have that baseline population I talked about that might be 8,246 last January, and that would actually go down a little bit and then grow so that by January 2016 there might be 8,652 vets in prison were it not for any of these other policies and laws that have been passed since then. And then down at the bottom, that total impact, which grows from 4,743 beds to 7,391 by the end of the forecast, that total policy impact is divided up, you know, according to those five policies we talked about. And then the picture looks the same. Measure 11 and repeat property account for almost all the growth. And finally, on the last page, there's a chart that shows the policy impacts on growth. Now, why the growth is slowing. For Measure 11, intakes, releases are growing, and sooner or later, someday, they will equal the number of intakes and the population will flatten out. Now, in the late 90s, nobody got out of prison. We had 60 people a month come in, none of them got out, so we had a really high growth rate, about 720 beds a year. Currently, we have about 58 per month coming in and 37 going out, so the population is just growing by 20 a month or 240 a year. By the end of the forecast, we forecast that 64 a month would be coming in and 55 going out, so now we're down to only 100 bed growth per year. With repeat property, the 30% and 25% growth rates and intakes that we've been having over the past few years, we have that, I guess, simmering down. We have a couple more years of double-digit growth until it settles down, still growing, but at a much lower rate. We could be wrong about that, but it's just hard for us and our committee to imagine, you know, 10 years with 30% growth. That sooner or later that, you know, the system would reach a capacity or another kind of crime would become more popular, technology, something that would stop that high growth trajectory. So in general, more growth, way less than what we've had in the last 11 years. And finally, there's some other impacts. We just can't quantify them. And they are on the downside. One of them is the Blakely decision. And it appears we had a year last year when intakes and prison growth were less than what we expected and less than what we'd seen, much less than what we've seen in the past few years. And we have some theories, but we really, you know, we can't put our hands on anything definite. And one of them is Blakely, that, you know, it was... We had people coming into prison before that had upward departures. Now they don't have those, so their length of stay is shorter. More people getting out earlier, that is going to tend to flatten the prison population growth. And then finally, the other one that is even harder to get our hands around is during 2003, in the spring, when there was that budget crunch, the circuit courts deferred some cases. And I have heard anecdotally that some of those cases, eventually the people ended up pleading to a misdemeanor. Now, if that were the case, we could have somewhat of a dilution of people's criminal histories. So, say the court hadn't slowed down, it was business as usual, people would have come, they might have pled to a felony, then a certain number of them would reoffend. Now they have a criminal history score with a felony, might have got some people into prison. There's a number of people now, they don't have that felony, they have a misdemeanor, so they end up going to felony probation. And that's a theory that we've talked about with a committee, but we just, with the data that we have and how complicated and complex all the considerations are in each case, there's just no way to get our hands on it, but it seems like that was a plausible theory. So those are a couple of things that were going on that have also slowed the prison population growth. And that's all I had. And I thank you for inviting me to come down. It's really beautiful here, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have. couple to start off. On the Measure 11 related crimes going up, is it your sense that that has been the result of perhaps plea deals from Measure 11 where they make a plea, but they make sure that there's an actual sentence attached to it?
Yes, Chair Burdick, the information that we have got through our committee is that, you know, most cases don't go to trial, and there are some where it's everybody agrees a prison sentence, but not a mandatory minimum.
So that would be an indirect Measure 11.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just, in the last special session, we put in some new mandatory sentences for the worst sex offenders. Is that already incorporated in Measure 11, or how are you going to account for that in the forecast?
Chair Burdick, our forecast is current law, and our forecast was released before your special session, so it isn't incorporated, but we are going to meet a population graph. And that's all I had. And I thank you for inviting me to come down. It's really beautiful here, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
A couple to start off. On the Measure 11 related crimes going up, is it your sense that that has been the result of perhaps plea deals from Measure 11 where they make a plea, but they make sure that there's an actual sentence attached to it?
Yes, Chair Burdick, the information that we have got through our committee is that, you know, most cases don't go to trial, and there are some where it's everybody agrees a prison sentence, but not a mandatory minimum.
So that would be an indirect Measure 11.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just, in the last special session, we put in some new mandatory sentences for the worst sex offenders. Is that already incorporated in Measure 11, or how are you going to account for that in the forecast?
Chair Burdick, our forecast is current law, and our forecast was released before your special session, so it isn't incorporated, but we are going to meet tomorrow with Mr. Prinz, because we forecast out farther than the legislative impacts normally are, two sessions. And I had initially kind of written it off like it might not have much impact, but we're going to get together and have a closer look. In any case, any impact it would have would be 7 to 10 years out, because we would be taking someone with a, you know, 7-8 year Measure 11 sentence and expanding it out to 25. So it's just a question of how many people would are going to be affected by that, and that's what we need to kind of get our heads around.
And on the repeat property offenders, you say that your sense is that they're going to go down. Are you assuming that there are going to be legislative measures taken on ID theft, or, you know, what are the assumptions there? Because ID theft, from everything I hear, is just doing nothing but growing.
Yes, Chair Burdick, no, it's all current policy, and we do have 2 years anyway of high growth, and we had in our committee some kind of agonizing discussions about that, and you know, what we're trying to get at is how long can a system continue to grow 30% every year? Can it do that for 10 years? not likely. We're trying to get to the most likely scenario. It could happen, but 10 years is a long time. And you know, there's technology that might help people be victimized less. There might be some other crime that we haven't even thought of that will take its place. So what we did with that is just gradually ramp down the growth rate. So intakes continue to grow throughout the 10 years, but not at 25 and 30%. It gradually goes down. And we're just going to have to watch it every year and see what we get. But, I mean, it's possible, but it doesn't seem likely that we would get that, you know, continued 25, 30% growth rate for 10 years. I mean, that seemed like a pretty, kind of a pretty reckless prediction for us. So, you know, we were trying to get to the most likely scenario.
Hope you're right. Any questions from the committee? And to visit.
Chair Burdick, thank you. Ms. Porter, has the Office of Economic Analysis attempted to quantify the cost savings of Major 11 sentencing related to the reduction in property and personal crimes committed as a result of keeping the offenders in prison, as a result of the reduction in police and court costs and apprehending and convicting recidivists, and the possible crime deterrent of Major 11 sentencing?
Chair Burdick, Senator Woodsett, no, we have not. Our charge is to forecast the prison population for the Department of Corrections for budgeting. So even this analysis is, you know, kind of something special that we did. It's not normally what we do. And, you know, there's no doubt there's some impact of what you're saying, but, you know, we haven't been asked to do it, and it would be, it would be a pretty big research project to do something like that. And normally our charge is just getting the numbers right for prison, community corrections, for budgeting. So no, we have not done anything like that.
Madam Chair, that might be something we might want to look at, because we're always looking for cost-benefit analyses. And we're on the one side, we're looking at costs, but we really should look at the, in my opinion, the benefit on the, and the benefit obviously is primarily in the private sector, in the reduction in crime and the reduction in suffering and so forth. So I think it might be a worthwhile thing to do.
Probably would be an ambitious process. The purpose of the prison population projection, one of the big purposes is to determine how many prisons we need. So we need to make sure we take care of that business. Are there other... Representative Berger.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. I'm fairly new to judiciary, and I'm not familiar particularly with this operation. See its value, you have to be able to predict. Would you give me some idea, do you keep track of how you do on your predictions? Are you generally dead on? Or do policy impacts, unpredictable, always keep you sort of behind the eight ball? Just give me a sense of this.
Co-chairs and Representative Berger, we do keep track of how we do. And we have a methodology review we do every year that I just completed. And for prison population, going back to April of 97 forecast, let's see here, we have been within 1.5%. Eight of those 14 forecasts. And then that's within what we do, that we're especially focused on our performance between 6 and 30 months, because we put a forecast out in the odd number year when the legislature's in session, and they're going to use that to build a budget for the coming biennium. So we especially want to be right in that time period. And we have, let's see. Yeah, those are 8 of the 14. Then we have 10 forecasts that are older than that, and 7 of those are within a percent. Okay, we have 7, sorry, 7 of our forecasts that are older than 30 months old, 7 of the 10 are within a percent and a half between that critical window of time. For the most part, we stay under that, and we've had a few in the early part of this decade. Those forecasts are running a little low, and then there's in the October 03 through October 04, those are running a little high. So, but our error is seldom over 2%, but there are a few way back there that are 3%. So that's about how our performance is. There's one thing about Measure 11 with the mandatory minimum sentences and the number of people that come in is almost like clockwork. The same number of people come in every month. They don't have earned time credit. So we know exactly when they're going to get out. So that that's made it easier to forecast accurately.
Measure 11.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions for you, Suzanne. First question is it deals with, through your research, did you take a look at any comparative studies throughout the nation of other states that have similar guidelines to ours and where we're comparing for the prison population and the forecast with that?
Representative Olson, you're thinking how did they grow?
Right.
No, I haven't done that. In fact, I did this last week for this hearing. But we could take a look at it. The trouble is that a lot of states have also passed different, you know, mandatory minimum laws. Washington comes to mind. But I'm pretty sure Washington hasn't had the growth that we have. But that would be one I could look at. They have a three strikes law, but it's not used often. But I could do that. If you were interested, we could, you know, the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics probably has some information already done that I could get my hands on and get it to you if you'd like.
Yeah, it would be interesting. Okay. I don't want you to knock yourself out over that, though. I mean, that's,
right.
It would be interesting for me. The other question that I have, too, is since you mentioned Senate Bill 145 into the equation, I know of two counties that have since pulled out of that, Douglas County here as well as Lynn. Any huge impact from what you've seen from their pulling out of the system?
I have not seen any impact because as far as I know, and Ginger is here, that can illuminate more, but I think that the program is run the same way. It's just run with Department of Corrections staff, and that population kind of goes up and down throughout the year, but I haven't noticed any significant growth or decline. It's just humming along like it always does. So no, I don't look at individual counties, just look at the whole state. So Ginger would really be able to give you more information on that, but statewide I don't see it.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions, Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Porter, in local jails, it's my understanding that capacity plays a role in how many people are incarcerated. That is, that if there's not jail beds to house somebody, particularly for a lesser offense, they may be released earlier. Is there any dynamic like that in our state prison population, or is there always sufficient capacity to hold people till the end of the whatever sentence has been prescribed to them?
Co-chairs, Representative McPherson, because we have sentencing guidelines and Measure 11 and other presumptive sentences, that people have to complete their sentence before they're released, and there has to be room for them, whether it's here or whether it's rented in another state or from a county. And there have been, in the late 90s, there was a time when we were renting beds out of state. Now, there are a few people still left under the old parole system, but these are serious, you know, serious offenders that have been in prison since 1989, you know, they predate, so they're not the kind of people that we're going to be, the parole board is, you know, going to let out because they need the room. So as far as I know, there's some way or other the capacity has to be there, whether we rent it or build it.
Follow up, Madam Chair, if I could. Seize the moment. To accommodate in-state the 16,000 inmates that we would, if I follow the projection right, the current projection is that in 10 years from now we'll have a population of about 16,000 inmates. What facilities would need to come online in order to accommodate those in-state? Or do we have enough on the drawing board to accommodate that population?
Co-chairs, Representative McPherson, that is not my area, but Department of Corrections, the staff here can answer that question. I mean, I know that there are, there's Madras, there's Junction City and White City that have been cited, but, and I think if those were all to be built, that there would be more than enough room, but how they, I mean, they have their construction schedule, like, planned out. That's what they do with these numbers. So I'm not really intimately involved in that. But I think that those sites were made back in the old days before I did this forecast, right after the ballot measure was passed, and they were predicting like 20,000 inmates by right now. And I think that those areas were cited with that in mind. So, I mean, I would definitely ask that question to the Department of Corrections, but I think there's more than enough, like, land set aside.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions? Representative Putz.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thought you'd get that right. I have several questions, but my colleagues have asked them all. Mrs. Porter, does the... is it you or Mrs. Martin that would be looking at the population makeup as far as the, if, do we have a significant number of illegal immigrants, and were there any immigration policy changes would impact our overall population?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, that is not one of the groups. I just look at custody level and gender so that, you know, there's enough. But I, you know, I see in the data there are people in there with INS holds, so it's not INS anymore. But they have detainers on them, so there are some. How many, I don't know, but I would think that that corrections will have that number.
Representative Krueger, did you have anything? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next. Section is reentering recidivism, and I'll turn the gavel over to the chair.
Thank you very much.
Ginger Martin.
Yeah, Ginger Martin, please.
I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, responsible for the Transitional Services Division. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm here to talk about the Department of Corrections transition and prison to community reentry, and also the alternative incarceration program, and then I'll be reviewing some information about recidivism following prison. The mission of the Department of Corrections is really a two-part mission. our mission is to promote public safety generally, but by doing two things, by holding offenders accountable and for their actions and also reducing the risk of future criminal behavior. And it's the second part of that mission that really speaks to our responsibility to do a good job preparing inmates to be successful when they leave prison and to be safe members of the community after they spend their time doing their incarceration sentence. So our primary goal in transition is to address community safety by preparing someone who's been incarcerated to be successful, to live successfully in the community, and to decrease the chances that they will become involved in criminal behavior after they leave our prison system. We release 300 to 400 inmates every month. We have had a focused initiative to improve transition with the Department of Corrections since 1999, and since that time we've made a number of both small and large changes that help us do a better job with this part of the corrections business. And we continue in that initiative. We're certainly not where we would like to be in terms of good preparation, but we've really come quite a long way since 1999. One of the aspects of information that we have taken into account as we've looked at our system and thought about how to make it work better, there's a growing body of research that tells us how we can have a greater impact on reducing recidivism, and we've looked to that research to design what happens to people when they're in prison. So we are specifically now assessing for criminal risk factors, so we know what the drivers are of the criminal behavior that each individual brings with them when they come to prison. And we're also assessing their risk to reoffend, because we know that we need to pay more attention to the people who are more likely to reoffend. And as we're paying attention to those people, we need to be paying attention specifically to those characteristics they have that contribute or are likely to contribute to their ongoing criminal behavior. And to that end, then, we've designed programs inside the prison that target criminal risk factors, and we have been focusing on more our services on those who are more likely to reoffend. So if you have a high risk to reoffend and you have an alcohol and drug problem driving that, we will prioritize you for our treatment programs over someone who perhaps has a less serious problem, a less chance of reoffending. We know that when we deliver programs that are designed appropriately for offenders, that target the high-risk offenders, that target the criminal risk factors, and that are delivered in ways that work for offenders, that we, looking at the national research, people are finding recidivism reductions of about 30% from programs that are properly designed. And that's compared to programs which are offered to offenders but not particularly designed for offenders. Those programs tend to not have an effect on recidivism, or possibly even to be associated with higher rates of recidivism. So too, when we only do the punishment part of corrections and don't address these long-term behavior change needs, that punishment in itself doesn't have an effect on recidivism for most people. And again, the research really tells us what works best for most. And what works best for most is to pair the criminal justice punishment along with some kind of long-term behavior change or treatment program. So planning for a successful transition really begins at the moment that an inmate enters the prison system, and we do that assessment. So they come into the intake center, which happens to be located in Wilsonville, and we assess inmates not just for their risk inside, their custody level, that we will want to manage them within. We also assess their medical and mental health needs, and we assess their criminal risk factors. And then we create an individual intervention plan for them based on those criminal risk factors. And then people are assigned to an institution, and we've evolved our system in such a way that we have some institutions that focus on education and work. There are more long-term institutions, and we have identified some institutions that specialize on release and release preparation. Those institutions include Columbia River in Portland, Snake River out east, a number in the Salem area. Coffee Creek, of course, is our women's prison. They release everywhere. And Shutter Creek releases to the southern part of the state. And we have a couple of program-specific release sites, like Powder River, which is an all-treatment institution, and the Summit Program at Shutter Creek, which is the boot camp program. And those programs release everywhere. One of the advantages of specializing our institutions in this way, it allows us to concentrate our release preparation into regional facilities, which are as close as we can get someone to the community to which they will be returning. And that allows for a greater interaction between the parole officer and the inmate before release. And occasionally, sometimes also, service providers will come into the institution and begin to work with an inmate before they leave and return to their community. We've done some things organizationally to make that access easier. It's hard to get into a prison, if you haven't committed a crime. So if you wanted to come and visit a prison, we have a whole process to get you in there. We were making it kind of difficult for parole officers to get in, too, just because of the administrative rules that we had in place. So we made some changes there, made that process easier, made our boundaries a little more permeable so that service providers who have a legitimate role and are important to transition can get in a little easier. Another thing that we've done that's helped us improve our transition planning is our sentence calculation folks do of course they calculate the sentence when someone comes into the prison system, but they also have as part of their process a sort of recheck or a quality assurance check nearer to release to make sure that all of the various factors that influence a release date have been incorporated into our sentence calculation. They used to do that final check about 4 months from release, and sometimes that release date changes at that time. New information comes in, and that doesn't allow much time for good transition planning. So one of the changes we've made in our system is to do that final check, move that back a little bit so that we're doing that at about 6 months, which gives us a good frame date that we can plan around. In terms of what happens inside the releasing institutions, most of the releasing institutions have put together some transition preparation classes that help people think through employment, become more employable, prepare for job hunting, prepare resumes, get some information on budgeting and money management, find out what it's like to be on parole. They get some preparation for what are the conditions of your supervision likely to be. Ideally, they have some contact with their parole officer before they leave, either by phone or in person. So kind of getting people ready to think about how they're going to support themselves, where are they going to live, what kind of ongoing treatment are they going to need when they leave, what services are available in the community to which they're going to return. I'm going to talk about alternative incarceration programs later in the presentation, but those are certainly reentry programs. A couple of other system improvements that we have put in place. We have the offender debit card, which is essentially an Oregon Trail card, same kind of card someone might get if they were receiving food stamps. Inmates who leave with some money on their books leave with an Oregon Trail card, which allows them to access their funds immediately when they leave. Instead of, in the old days, we issued a check and we released people without ID. So their ability to access the meager funds they might have available to them to help with their own transition, that was a huge barrier to people. So now they've got some access to the dollars that they have available, either that that they've earned or that their family has sent them. Another kind of interesting pilot program that we intend to expand is an inmate reentry savings account. We piloted this program at the Powder River Institution, and it's a mandatory release savings account. So any dollars that come into an offender's trust account, 5% of those dollars are diverted to be invested, held for them until they release. And then they can go out with a little bit more resource at their at the ready so that they can take care of their immediate needs when they release. This has been such a popular program for the inmates that they've actually saved more than their required percentage. So inmates understand that importance of having some resource available to them when they leave, and they've actually placed more money in their reentry savings account. Let's see. Home for Good is another one of our developing transition programs. This is a program developed by our religious services unit, and it involves setting up community chaplains similar to the prison chaplains in each of the communities in Oregon, and then inmates who would like that kind of support. And we see this as a support for pro-social behavior, support for not continuing in a criminal lifestyle, to connect someone with a community chaplain so they have that kind of support available to them when they leave. And also most community chaplains have some idea about the community services, and that might be available to someone when they return home. We do spend extra time with some special kinds of releases. People with very serious medical problems or mental health problems do get more service coordination from inside to outside than your general release. And we, again, are really encouraging community corrections pro-officers to reach into the institution and help orient people before they leave to what the expectations are going to be when they get out the door. And one of the significant improvements we've made since we started down this path in 1999 is to automate our release plans. Every inmate who leaves the institution has a plan. In the past, that plan was a lot of times not very detailed. And so we've been putting quite a lot of effort into creating a more comprehensive plan. But it's also automated now, which means that every parole officer and every institution counselor has access to the inmate's release plan on their desktop. And, you know, the key to good transition planning, really, if you were to pick just one thing, is the sharing of information about this inmate's behavior, criminal risk factors, programs, needs that we identify inside, and sharing that information with the parole officer who will be managing the case when that person leaves us. So the automated release plan does include that information about criminal risk factors and programs. It also includes plans for where this person is going to live, how they plan to support themselves, what continuum of services might be needed when they leave their prison. The plan is sent to the parole officer 90 days before release, and one of the jobs of the parole officer is to go and investigate the planned housing situation to make sure that it is a good place for that. To the prison chaplains in each of the communities in Oregon, and then inmates who would like that kind of support. And we see this as a support for pro-social behavior, support for not continuing in a criminal lifestyle, to connect someone with a community chaplain so they have that kind of support available to them when they leave. And also most community chaplains have some idea about the community services, and that might be available to someone when they return home. We do spend extra time with some special kinds of releases. People with very serious medical problems or mental health problems do get more service coordination from inside to outside than your general release. And we, again, are really encouraging community corrections parole officers to reach into the institution and help orient people before they leave to what the expectations are going to be when they get out the door. And one of the significant improvements we've made since we started down this path in 1999 is to automate our release plans. Every inmate who leaves the institution has a plan. In the past, that plan was a lot of times not very detailed. And so we've been putting quite a lot of effort into creating a more comprehensive plan. But it's also automated now, which means that every parole officer and every institution counselor has access to the inmate's release plan on their desktop. And, you know, the key to good transition planning, really, if you were to pick just one thing, is the sharing of information about this inmate's behavior, criminal risk factors, programs, needs that we identify inside, and sharing that information with the parole officer who will be managing the case when that person leaves us. So the automated release plan does include that information about criminal risk factors and programs. It also includes plans for where this person is going to live, how they plan to support themselves, what continuum of services might be needed when they leave the prison. The plan is sent to the parole officer 90 days before release, and one of the jobs of the parole officer is to go and investigate the planned housing situation to make sure that it is a good place for that person to live. And then once that happens, the Board of Parole gets the plan. And the Board of Parole sets the conditions of supervision, but they do that in consultation with the institution counselor and also the parole officer. And then once somebody leaves prison, community corrections agencies have an array of both supports and monitoring and supervision available. Many communities have set up transitional housing for offenders. In fact, Douglas County has a transitional house for folks that need some kind of structure in a living environment. There's never enough of that sort of thing, and when I talk to people about what's needed to improve transition, housing always comes up. But most communities and community corrections agencies have done quite a lot of work in setting up transitional housing settings for people and prioritizing those with the greatest need to do that. All communities have some funds for emergency needs like clothing and food and housing and medication. Again, there's never enough of that sort of thing, but there are some funds available for that. And then community corrections agencies use a variety of methods to provide monitoring for offenders when they first come out. So they might have people report in very frequently. They may use a day reporting structure where ex-inmate offender has to report in each day, make a plan for the day, and be looking for work, that kind of thing. Some communities have mentoring programs. The Home for Good program provides mentoring. So there's sort of this balance of addressing the stability needs, because we know if people need a stable place to live and a way to support themselves, they're going to be much less likely to reoffend. So those are important to address, strictly from a public safety standpoint. So there's the monitoring, there's the stability needs that are both an important part of transition once that offender gets to the community. And then in addition, the community corrections agencies continue to address the causes of crime through referrals to various programs. Community corrections agencies also respond to violations. This thing's ringing. I don't know why.
It's ringing?
I said, this is ringing.
Oh.
Where are you going?
I don't know where it came from.
There's a query. Come on. I'll have to look it up. Oh.
Go to voicemail.
Go to voicemail.
So in a balanced community corrections approach, we have monitoring, we have responding to violations, and we have addressing criminal risk factors and stability. Community corrections agencies respond to violations through a number of community-based sanctions like electronic home detention, community service worker work crews. They may increase the supervision contacts, called intensive supervision. They may place someone in a work release facility, require them to attend day reporting, and they do use jail for sanctions. So it's just part of the balanced supervision approach that deals both with problems and violations as well as the kind of long-term change that we hope people will engage in. The department has set for itself a number of measures to see how are we doing in our efforts to improve transition, and we're just beginning to collect feedback information for ourselves on this, on some of these measures. But certainly we intend to prepare inmates for successful transition, and so in order to find out how well we're doing on that, we're creating a report card for ourselves that will monitor things like of inmates leaving prison, what percent have housing, what percent are employed when they leave us, what percent of our higher risk inmates had a release plan that was developed with the parole officer and the inmate and the institution counselor. So how well are we doing with the collaborative planning? We want to look at what percentage of our high and medium risk offenders are actually getting the programs that they need while they're in prison, and what percentage are completing those programs. So we're trying to create some feedback loops for ourselves to kind of monitor how are we doing with the transition preparation. And then also how well are the inmates doing immediately when they leave. And so we'll be looking at short-term evidence of violations and employment, absconding,
take
that kind of thing. That's a brief overview of our efforts on improving transition and making that period of time from institution to community more successful. The committee wanted to know also something about our alternative incarceration programs. We have two types of alternative incarceration programs. One of them is the more cognitively oriented and behaviorally oriented program that exists at Summit in Coos County. That program started in 1994, usually called a boot camp program. Our alternative incarceration programs were expanded in 2003 to include an intensive alcohol and drug treatment program. And we have 225 beds of alcohol and drug treatment that fits into the alternative incarceration program. So there are 150 beds in the Summit program and 225 alcohol and drug treatment beds. Alternative incarceration programs are very intensive programs. They're designed really to structure an inmate's day from waking to sleeping. They are 6 months long with the institution phase, and each of them includes also a three-month transitional leave period in which the individual leaves the program and is supervised in the community, but is still technically an inmate. And so if that person were to have problems with compliance, breaking rules, that kind of thing, they can be brought back into the prison and they will serve out their complete term. Alternative incarceration programs do allow a time cut for people who complete the program and successfully complete transitional leave, and at that time those people go on post-prison supervision. The average time cut for an alternative incarceration program is 385 days, so it's just a little bit over a year. 87% complete the institution phase, and about 88% complete transitional leave. So people who get into those programs tend to do pretty well, in spite of the fact that they're pretty intensive. In order to get into an alternative incarceration program, there are a number of qualifications. The judge has to allow it, first and foremost. So in the sentencing order, the judge has to have made an alternative incarceration program available to that person, and also the transitional leave part of the program. No one with a mandatory minimum can go into the alternative incarceration program, and there are a number of disqualifying crimes as well. So murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, arson, rape, sodomy, sexual abuse, incest, sexual penetration, and contributing to the sexual delinquency of the minor are specifically prohibited from entering the program. You have to be minimum custody because all of our AIP programs are in our minimum facilities. And you have to have enough time to complete the 270-day program. And we don't typically take people who have an ICE hold or a felony detainer that might impact their ability to do the transitional leave portion of the program. Also, people have to volunteer. So if an inmate is eligible but doesn't volunteer, he or she won't go into that program. So once they volunteer, then we assess all of these eligibility factors and put them on the wait list, and they eventually move to the program. Because they can move to the program once they, if they're eligible, and when they reach minimum custody, it's possible to go into the program any time from 3 years left on. But it typically doesn't work that way. That, again, the majority of our folks are getting into the program, and their eventual sentence reduction is just over a year. We have some preliminary information on the effects of the AIP programs, and Paul Barati couldn't be here today, or he'd be telling you about this, so I get to. We looked at the Summit program, our long-time existing AIP program, and also the alcohol and drug treatment programs. The very early preliminary data shows both programs have show some effect on recidivism in a positive direction over a matched comparison group. So Paul Barati did a, what does he call it? He creates twins, essentially. So he'll take people who've completed the program, find a twin who matches that individual on a number of characteristics, and then look at the difference in recidivism rates for the treatment group and the twin group. In both situations, both types of programs, we saw a reduction in recidivism over the group of non-treated individuals who were similar. With the Summit program, the reduction was about a third, but Paul is still cautioning us because the group was fairly small and we had only a short time to watch them. So that's why we're being a little hesitant with, you know, publishing this data yet, because it's likely to change once we get a longer time to watch these people and a larger group to kind of incorporate. But what we're seeing is definitely going in the right direction. So the recidivism rates for the Summit program after, during the period of time that we watched people, and in order to be in the study, they had to have been out at least 6 months, but you know, that's a very short period of time. Some were out longer. He looked at a group with varying times at risk. And the difference between the two groups, 11% recidivism for the non-Summit group and 7.5% for the Summit group. The alcohol and drug treatment program participants showed a greater reduction in recidivism, which was statistically significant and was very positive. It really reduced the recidivism rates by over a half compared to the comparison group. So the comparison group recidivism was 18%, and the AIP participants was 7.5%. So it's very good, actually. Paul thinks perhaps over time it may not look quite so good, but we're pretty confident that the program is having the effect that we would want it to have. Alternative incarceration programs always save money because of the reduction in prison time. But that's not a sufficient reason in the correction system to offer a program. The reason in the correction system to offer a program is its effect on future criminal behavior. So this is what we're looking for in order to remain supportive of these programs, is it contributing something to improve public safety? And it would appear that these programs are in fact doing that, as well as providing some financial savings with the year time cut. So we're now sort of moving on to general recidivism. We do measure recidivism in people who are on post-prison supervision and parole. We measure that every 6 months. So we're looking at six-month release groups. And you have a chart, and folks who picked up a chart from the table, you'll see data from people who entered post-prison supervision starting in 1998. And in six-month groups all the way up to January of 2002. So the people who started post-prison supervision in January 2002 completed their three-year window that we look at them for 3 years. So they finished that in January of 2005. And you can see from the graph that our recidivism rates were fairly flat for a long time. In the last reporting period, we saw a dip. So we don't know yet if the dip is a trend, but naturally we're certainly hoping that that's the case. And I should say what our definition of recidivism is. Some of you are familiar with that, but some may not be. We look at reconviction of a felony within 3 years of starting supervision. The reason we found reconviction is not necessarily because that's the very best measure of recidivism. We use that because that's the very best and reliable data that we have. And so if we're going to look for trends, we want to use data that's accurate. So that's the reason for picking that particular measure. And we're looking, obviously, for that recidivism rate to go down and not up. It's a kind of barometer on how well is our system working in terms of impacting future criminal behavior. It's not a measure, obviously, of criminal behavior, and there isn't such a thing, truly. I mean, we don't catch everyone who commits a crime when they leave prison, so any recidivism data we might want to look at is going to show us relative trends up or down, as opposed to an absolute measure of new criminal behavior. Nevertheless, if we had available to us other accurate data, we could certainly look at recidivism from other views, and you know, we'd be happy to do that. As our system changes, perhaps we get better at having all of our criminal justice system databases talk to each other. We may be able to look at recidivism from some other views. But at this point, for many years now, our data has been reported at looking at reconviction of a felony. That doesn't mean, by the way, return to prison. About 20 to 22% of these people return to prison, whereas about 30% have been reconvicted. So that means some of them are being reconvicted of a crime for which they receive a probation sentence rather than a prison sentence. The committee is also interested in the relative recidivism rates of various age groups. And conventional wisdom is that younger people tend to recidivate at higher rates than older people. And in fact, our data shows that to be true. You have a chart that shows this as well. The highest recidivating group happens to be the 18 to 24-year-olds. And you can see recidivism rates drop off precipitously by age group. So by the time we get to the 61 and older, the rate is about 3.8% compared to 33% for the 18 to 24 age group. Are you having trouble finding that chart? It was handed out separately.
Okay, it's in here.
Looks like this. In terms of the types of crimes that tend to feed into the recidivism rates, they are pretty dramatically driven by drug use. Of all of the crimes of reconviction, so we take our group who've been to prison and now they've been reconvicted of a felony, 51% of those new crimes are drug crimes, and 20% of them are theft, which typically is also driven by addiction. So that's what, 70, almost three-quarters of the crimes of reconviction are somehow related to addiction or alcohol and drug use. So pretty clear where we need to be investing correctional resources in terms of long-term change and impacting recidivism is around alcohol and drug treatment, both inside the prison and in the community. That's the end of my formal remarks, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Any members have some questions? Senator Walker, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank
you, Justice. You said the parole officers get 6 months' notice, and talking to some parole officers, they're so busy. Are they actually having time to do this? Are they able to get that done?
Co-chairs, Representative Barker, it's variable. Some community corrections agencies have prioritized transition amongst all of the things that they have to do, and they may assign a specialized officer to reach in. Many agencies have carried out that function that way, as opposed to having each officer trying to reach into someone they might supervise at release. We have really pretty good participation from, I'd say, a third of the counties who are actually making quite an effort to do that kind of pre-release contact. And also, some counties may prioritize who they reach in for. So many counties would prioritize some offender that they're particularly concerned about, a very high-risk offender, someone that really poses a risk to the community, may invest a little bit more officer time in someone like that than someone they're not so concerned about. So it varies.
One more, a little different subject. On this, what we call boot camp, before it was boot camp. So somebody gets sentenced, they're going to go 5 years when they volunteer. So they get out in a short period of time. If they reoffend, do they go back and they look at the 5 years add on to their sentence, or is that just kind of something that doesn't count anymore?
Co-chairs, Representative Barker, if they fail at any time during the program, including during the 90-day transitional leave, they will come back and do their initial, their original sentence. So they'll lose the entire time cut and do their 5 years.
But once they're out of that and they're on parole and they re-violate, then it does not, or?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Burdick?
Yes, thank you. You said that over 50% of the repeat crimes are drug crimes. What are you counting as a drug crime? Are you counting other felonies? Because it has to be a pretty serious drug crime to actually get prison time. Are you counting other felonies where someone was drug impaired, or are you counting strict drug crimes? So what is in that statistic?
Senator Burdick, do keep in mind that these aren't necessarily prison-bound individuals. So some of these might be probations attached to a drug crime. And I actually don't have the list of the drug crimes, but my presumption would be a fair number of those are possession, and these folks aren't necessarily coming to prison.
So it's not necessarily how would you quantify a crime where, say, somebody committed a rape, but they also had a drug crime? I mean, how would you quantify that?
Senator Burdick, we always take the most serious crime when we report a crime type for an individual. So when I'm saying the drug crime was the crime of reconviction, that means that was the most serious crime for which they were reconvicted.
It's a pretty stunning statistic. It was 50% something with drug crimes, mm-hmm. and then what was the 20% one? That was
theft.
Theft.
Yeah.
That's
what mm-hmm. we saw before.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski?
Thank you. Regarding the transitional housing, I wonder if you could kind of explain to us how the department is working with those who are providing that. Specifically, I know that there is an organization in Eugene, sponsors that back in the early 90s actually had a contract or a grant system with the department where they actually had a very intense program of housing, supervision, assisting in getting jobs, drug treatment, and other people that were within that program. They were just people coming out. They weren't handpicked. I believe they had somewhere in the range of 30 individuals, and after 1 year, only one of them was actually out of compliance. So it seems to me that's one place that we can really put our money. And I wonder if you could tell us exactly how that works as to qualifying a location and how much assistance does the corrections department have after the individual is released.
Co-chairs, Senator Prozanski, the Department of Corrections doesn't currently contract with any community service provider directly. We have intergovernmental agreements with each county, and the county agencies decide how they're going to invest their community corrections funds. Many counties do invest in transitional housing. Is the program you're referring to the sponsors program?
It is.
The sponsors program is a model transition program for the state, and probably one of the best developed and certainly the oldest of the transitional programs. That's a local decision, however, about how to invest the state dollars that are community corrections dollars. Although I do agree with you, it's an important aspect of a successful approach.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. I assume the dollars you're talking about is the money that is this the money that will be coming from either 1145.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ginger, getting back to the inmate reentry savings and account pilot, I find that kind of interesting that you're doing that. Do you have a ballpark figure how much money is saved when an inmate leaves? what they're looking at.
Co-chair's Representative Olson, I don't have that in my brain, but we have enough experience with it that we certainly have that information.
Okay. And then the other question is, Chair, I blew a little bit. It deals with the AIP. You had mentioned that the judge during sentencing determines whether or not an inmate is eligible for the alternative incarceration program. I also know that there's an administrative rule that provides for the Department of Corrections to also plug that in. How often does that occur?
Co-chair's Representative Olson, it's within the administrative rule that we, for example, have the qualification that someone must be minimum custody. So we aren't, we have some maybe more management related rules in the qualifications in our rule. So for example, if someone has a serious mental illness or a serious physical problem that would prevent them from participating, or they've been a behavior problem inside, those are things that might screen someone out because they can't be managed at this, in this setting. And so our rule really kind of deals with who can be managed in the setting in which we have the program located, as opposed to saying, you know, going back to the criminal history and saying this person doesn't qualify. We also do some assessment for sex offender risk and might screen someone out who was a predatory sex offender but might otherwise qualify, although most sexual offenses are prohibited in law from participating.
Okay, I follow up, Mr. Chambers. Okay, again, though, I'm curious, of the two different types of AIP, could you nail it down for me, the percentage of those folks that are involved in that, those two programs, that would maybe have been directed as a result of Department of Corrections, the administrative rule?
Co-chair's Representative Olson, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, of the 150 beds that are in the boot camp program with the Summit, and the 225 beds that are involved with the A&D for AIP program, again, going back to mentioning, were the courts initially involved with identifying that, but also referring now to the administrative rule, of those beds, of those positions, how many of those are driven as a result of a determination for the administrative rule?
Representative Wilson, I'll try and answer your question. Everyone has to be eligible by virtue of their sentence to go into the program. We may screen some people out because they never reach minimum custody. We can't manage their other problems in the setting. They have a learning disability and can't benefit from the program. So we're not putting anyone in by virtue of an administrative rule. They first have to be eligible according to their sentence. We're screening some people out because of the administrative rule, driven again by who we can be successful with in the setting. Does that answer your question?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
That's okay. We can talk.
Okay.
We'll move on. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Ackerman. Yes, I understood your testimony. Participation in the alternative incarceration programs are voluntary on behalf of the eligible inmate, is that correct? And my question, therefore, is how many of those eligible actually participate, volunteer for the program? If you give us some overall number of the number of inmates in the programs that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs, Representative Ackerman, we actually don't know how many people come into the prison and are eligible because we don't screen them until they apply.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that about half of the people who come into prison apply, and about half of those are eligible. But we aren't sure of the half that apply. We don't know if there are others who might be eligible but never ask to be considered. So within the programs, we have 150 beds at the Summit program and 225 at the in the A&D programs. And because the programs are 6 months long, we can pass about twice that many people through the programs each year.
We represent.
Representative Wilson, I'll try and answer your question. Everyone has to be eligible by virtue of their sentence to go into the program. We may screen some people out because they never reach minimum custody. We can't manage their other problems in the setting. They have a learning disability and can't benefit from the program. So we're not putting anyone in by virtue of an administrative rule. They first have to be eligible according to their sentence. We're screening some people out because of the administrative rule, driven again by who we can be successful with in the setting. Does that answer your question?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
That's good. We can talk.
Okay.
We'll move on. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Ackerman. Yes, if I understood your testimony, participation in the alternative incarceration programs are voluntary on behalf of the eligible inmates. Is that correct? And my question, therefore, is how many of those eligible actually participate, volunteer for the program? And could you give us some overall number of the number of inmates in the programs that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs, Representative Ackerman, we actually don't know how many people come into the prison and are eligible because we don't screen them until they apply.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that we know that about half of the people who come into prison apply, and about half of those are eligible. But we're not sure of the half that apply. We don't know if there are others who might be eligible but never ask to be considered. So within the programs, we have 150 beds at the Summit program and 225 at the in the A&D programs. And because the programs are 6 months long, we can pass about twice that many people through the programs each year.
Representative Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Wissett.
For the guy's strike.
I'm not going to lie, two guys with those names on the same committee ever again.
Even though they add a lot to your committee.
We're going to have to sacrifice.
Ms. Miller, back to the AIP program. So I'm not sure, do we have more demand than we have beds? The second question, are the program staff with DOC personnel? If so, have we looked at private programs operated either with off-site locations or on-site or government facilities but privately operated?
Co-chairs, Representative Wilson. The programs typically do have a waiting list, so we're not getting to everyone. The alcohol and drug programs are all operated through contracts with nonprofit treatment providers, so our treatment program itself is delivered by nonprofits. At the Summit program, we have DOC staff delivering most of the program activities there, although we do have a few contract service providers there as well.
Follow up?
Oh.
So again, successful program, have we looked at trying to expand the program with either private operator? Do we have facilities? Is it staff or facilities that's holding back?
Co-chairs, Representative Wilson, we actually were holding back a bit until we began to see what some of the outcome research would show us. We didn't want to expand the program before we knew what impact it was having on recidivism. And now that we're seeing that that's certainly going in the right direction, you know, I think it's time now to think about some expansion. We certainly could think about it now.
Representative Wisnett, thank you, Mr.
Excuse me, Senator Walker was first.
Thank you. I'm not sure, is Dr. Bellotti here today? Did he testify or maybe he's not present? I'm not sure you're going to be able to answer my question then. I'm in possession of a letter that was sent to Senator Schrader in May 16th, by Nancy Sellers, giving him a report on the Depo-Provera program. And Dr. Bellotti did the research on that program. And for those of you who don't know what Depo-Provera is, they administer the drug to sex offenders, and it is to reduce their desire to offend. And what they found in the study was that treatment with Depo-Provera reduces recidivism in all inmates, sexual and non-sexual crimes. So would you be able to talk to us a little bit about that?
Co-Chair Senator Walker, I might be able to clarify one statement. I'm not terribly familiar with the research, but I know that the study population were all sex offenders. So when it says it reduces recidivism or was associated with reductions in recidivism, it's they're looking at criminal behavior and non-sexual criminal behavior in a group of sex offenders and also sexual behavior in a group of sex offenders. But I couldn't tell you why. But, I mean, why that effect, other than perhaps it's simply a correlation.
Okay. Yeah, and follow up, Mr. Chair. I just got the letter, and I didn't get all the attachments. I got the rule, but I didn't get the study paper. So, you know, contact Senator Schrader to help forward that to me. But because we were both very interested in both of us passed, worked on passing that legislation in 99 that set up this program. So I guess I'll have a conversation with Dr. Bilotti to get some more information about that, because if it can be used with non-sex offenders in the regular population, I think this is a really neat tool.
The study group was all sex offenders.
Yes.
So we can't draw conclusions to non-sex offenders from this particular work.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your caution, before you expand programs and your monitoring to see what the actual results are before you make sudden moves on these programs. But that led to a question. The early indications that you have are that the A&D program gets much better recidivism results than the Summit program. And I guess my question to you, especially in light of the meth issues that we're facing now and its correlation to other crimes, do you have the flexibility that you need if the Summit program would be a higher and better use of that facility, if a higher and better use would be for A&D, and particularly meth, and we did discuss this in our meth work group, do you have the flexibility you need to make a conversion if the data show that that would be a higher and better use for that facility?
Senator Burdick, our current law requires that we deliver a program there based on a military model. So it may not be consistent with the structure you might need to provide an intensive outcome of treatment under the existing statute. And if I may take a moment to clarify the reconviction data, because I realized as I was telling you the statistics, I was looking at our women's population. The men's population is similar but a little different. If we look at reconviction crimes for men, 44% were drug crimes and 12% were theft. So a little bit less than for women. Women obviously are being reconvicted at higher rates for drug-related crimes, but still, they're still our top two crimes of reconviction for men as well.
It's my recollection that when we put together the meth package, we did put a provision in that might allow more flexibility with the Summit program. I don't know if you're the right person to ask, but I would be very interested to know whether that's having any effect.
I'm sorry, Burdick, I should know, but I'm not remembering now exactly what the provision was. I remember the discussion. But again, we haven't, as an agency, had the information we felt we needed to expand until just very recently. And even now, Dr. Bilotti is, you know, really encouraging us not to assume the very good results we're seeing now are going to continue at that rate, although we still think that we're going to see a positive and worthwhile reduction in recidivism for the treatment programs.
Friends, can you elaborate?
Yeah. Senator Burdick and Representative Krieger, your bills, the two bills, House Bill 2485 and Senate Bill 907, can't remember which one of them.
What's that? ID yourself.
For the record, my name is Craig Prince from the Criminal Justice Commission.
Yeah.
It is in one of the bills, and it does allow for it. And I think, as Ginger was saying, DOC has just been waiting for the results. And if we want to revisit making it very clear that is allowed to make that transition, we can do that. But it's in one of the two bills that's in the meth package.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
One more follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. given the success of the A&D programs, that leads to another question. Not everyone in prison qualifies for AIP. And what facilities or what options do you have for prisoners who don't qualify to get alcohol and drug treatment within prison?
Senator Burdick, thank you for asking that question. I do think there's been so much attention placed on AIP that not everybody knows we have alcohol and drug treatment in prison for people who are not qualified for AIP. We're reaching about half of the people we ought to be able to reach now if we're just going to look at the high-risk people. But we do have intensive alcohol and drug residential treatment programs at the men's prison in Portland, at the women's prison, and we've just opened a new program for men. We moved a program, actually, from Pendleton to Salem and kind of redesigned it to fit what we know now about what works best for offenders, so it's a much more intensive residential program than the one we had up in Pendleton. So we do have some treatment availability for people who aren't eligible. We're also looking to our new Madras site for a couple of therapeutic community programs there, again, to address the treatment need from male inmates, and that's really where we're falling the shortest is in terms of capacity for that group.
And is this a situation where they have to volunteer for it as well?
Senator Burdick, everyone who receives treatment in the correction system essentially has to volunteer because they still have the right to agree to medical treatment, basically.
When you talk about residential treatment, is that within the prison or out in an outside facility?
Senator Burdick, I'm referring to a specialized housing unit in which all of the treatment participants live and receive treatment, so we can create an environment in which it's a much more powerful change environment, and we can really address the criminal thinking and criminal lifestyle by creating a place where that's not rewarded.
But it's within the prison.
It's within the prison.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? Yep. Okay, Representative Barker, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of, if I could back up to the, I think what Representative Olson, or at least he could with his question, or I didn't understand, but supposing I'm in trial, if I was in Baltimore County, maybe I had Judge Gallagher, and he swept through most of my trials and conferences with, and he forgot to say, you're eligible for the boot camp program. So then I come in, and I say, yeah, we don't have a period. Judge didn't recommend it. Can I get into the program then?
Co-chair, as Representative Barker, you cannot.
Okay, thank you. That's my
time. Wake him up.
Yeah.
Later. Going back to the question that was just asked about as it relates to getting into the program, about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, this issue came up, and Representative Olson was familiar with it. It came out of Lane County, and I think Joe Lear and I, and Craig Friends and I went back and looked at the record as it came out of Lane County, and I think some of the problem can be attributed to the issue of judicial administration, in the sense that what you had was a trial. The trial ended. It was a very controversial trial. It involved a police officer charged with certain crimes. And no mention was made of eligibility for the program at that time. But the judgment later did mention he was eligible for the program. So that's, I think, and has caused some confusion. I said, once again, it goes back to an issue of judicial administration, I think, more than the issue of the Department of Corrections. If I could follow up a question, Ms. Martin, and that is in the issue of your reentry programs. Do you have any data or statistics on these studies that show the reduction of recidivism rates through these programs? And if so, what does it translate into money versus cost of prison beds?
Co-chairs, Mr. Taylor, we don't have any data that would kind of look at specifically people who might have had some transition preparation compared to people who didn't. Partly because we don't have any new agency resources for these transition preparation programs. We're doing them with existing staff and existing resources, and they look a little different in each institution at this point. One of our goals would be to create a more consistent approach across all of our releasing institutions, and at that time I think it would make sense to begin to look at big difference. But right now, some of the difference is going to be just because the programs were different. I'm not sure if it would give us information that we could really use at this point.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. Ms. Martin, to follow up on Senator Prozaski's line of questioning earlier, apparently we're expecting the counties to utilize their $1,145 for community transition housing, such as sponsors. You know that at least two counties have dropped out of the 1145 program due to lack of funding, and several other rural counties are contemplating the same action because they simply can't afford to maintain the facilities with the monies that are available to them or being made available to them. So, does the Department of Correction have plans to begin to participate in these programs such as sponsors? If so, when? And if not, why not?
Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we, as the Department of Corrections, don't tend to place strings on the state grant to counties, assuming that counties and local jurisdictions know what their priorities are for their community and how they want to spend their grant. In the offices that we operate, we do have transitional housing opportunities in both of those communities. Some communities, and I actually don't know what our financial contribution is to those off the top of my head. Many communities develop transitional housing that is not necessarily financially supported by the jurisdiction. I mean, it really varies from county to county. There are, Oxford has options in lots of locations. So, and those don't typically take government money to start and operate. So each community has kind of a different array of available resources, and in some communities the community corrections funds are used directly to provide transitional services, transitional housing, and in some communities it's a more cooperative arrangement with other local service providers. So I guess the short answer is that we still have great respect at the state level for the local jurisdiction and their decision-making about how to use the resources that they have.
Please. The question was, does the Department of Correction have plans to participate with their funding in these community correction, these community transition housing projects?
Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we do that in our own field offices. Is your question more kind of a statewide?
It was my understanding from your previous response that that basically the Department of Corrections was leaving this up to the $1,145. Right. My question was that the $1,145 are obviously not adequate in some rural counties and perhaps in other counties to address this issue. Is the Department of Corrections planning to use some of their dollars or develop a program to help sponsor these very successful transition houses?
Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we don't have dollars in our budget for community-based transitional housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to go to me, because of this line of questioning, because it connects, and this is apropos to Senator Whitsitt's comments, the Revenue Committee met last week. I think I'm the only member here that sat in that committee. Were you there? Yes. And we listened to about 8 hours of testimony on homelessness and heard plenty of testimony from folks coming out of corrections that said homelessness and finding stable housing was the key. And yet, what I think we've got, and it's unfortunate, is these folks who have their little circle where they influence these people, and then they walk out the door, and it's hit or miss what they get, where they get it, who's providing it, depending on a host of factors. But at the same time, just pouring more money, I agree with Senator Witts that what we need is more information on what those critical pieces are once they leave the door here, to get them so they don't come back, and we need actual good data.
I'm not going to sit here and say that we've got the money to just pour money into transitional housing if we can't show the connection to how it's saving us money with folks not coming back. But clearly, it's a critical piece, and we've got to start dealing with it in a less of silos and more of a system, as Senator Wilson is clearly indicating.
Okay, Senator Babanski.
Mr. Chair, I guess this is kind of a follow-up on that question that I asked earlier, and that Senator Wissett and now Representative Berger's come up. It just seems to me that the 1145, I think Senator Starr and I are probably the only members that were here in 1995 when we voted on that. And my memory and my belief was that that money was actually to help offset by not having the obligation on the state to take in certain low offender inmates into the state system, having them maintained in the communities and counties. And I understand there could be the argument that, well, when you have someone coming out, we've shifted the parole and probation to the county level. But the reality is, it seems to me we got state prisoners coming out of state facilities into the community, and we don't have money actually following them to actually help them through that transition. And as Representative Burgers stated, what we heard this last week clearly has demonstrated the need for that. And when we have a program such as Sponsors that actually had a grant back in the early 90s and demonstrate how this can actually be effective in keeping all but one of this test group that was not hand-selected, just basically whoever came out the door, in compliance, it seems like we are not spending our money wisely, and we should in fact be diverting more money from the state level to help the counties through these transitional housing programs.
Hey, Mike, everybody looks at things different or hears things different, and I saw the similarity of the alternative incarceration with the legislative session where we do 6 months, they do 7 months. The release plan is like our end of session. They have to volunteer, we have to volunteer. Reentry recidivism means you're going to run for office again. And if alternative incarceration means you're running unopposed. That's how you hear it. But it was a good presentation, a lot of information. I appreciate it very much. I imagine you'll get some contact to come back. We're going to take a real quick break, and then we'll come back for the last little part, please.
House and Senate Judiciary Committee is here. That was a nice break, good food, good drink. And we are now back with the costs associated with prison bills, older inmates and mentally ill inmates, with Nathan Allen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathan Allen. I'm the Planning and Budget Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. If I could just start with an answer to Representative Wisnant's question with respect to illegal aliens. We currently have about 900 illegal aliens with ICE detainers in the system. ICE detainers in the system, so that is a significant portion of our population. I have in your notebooks three separate bundles of information, the first of which is a packet that deals with the construction program, and you had asked for some cost information relative to the construction of facilities, particularly in response to the prison population growth that Sue Porter had shared earlier this morning. Your copy of that would be a large folded schedule that has across the top of it all of the various facilities that have been or are currently planned to be constructed by the department. Also on the schedule are the various locations by city, the year of construction, the individual facility capacity of each prison, and then a cumulative column that's titled System Capacity that adds together the aggregate of the construction capacities as a system. So that's there for you to look at. The cost information is also listed in a section there near the center of the document. And you will note that directly below that is a line that shows the cost of financing for facilities that we have constructed since about 1995. What I would just say is that the lottery proceeds line that's at the bottom is a reflection of a strategy for construction financing prior to the 1995 time period. And so there obviously is no interest expense associated with that financing. But also at the very bottom, I have listed the legislatively adopted budgets for the operating elements at the facilities themselves. This value doesn't contain any of the program costs associated with education or A&D or any of those other services. So, in terms of where we are today, we are actually we have just recently completed the construction of the Warner Creek facility in Lakeview. We're currently working on expansions of Shutter Creek, adding an additional 100 beds for minimum inmates in the North Bend area, construction of the final 324 beds at the women's facility in Wilsonville, and the Deer Ridge Correctional Facility in Madras is well under construction, and that's what's on the drawing board thus far. In the future, we have two remaining sites that have been purchased as part of the supersiding process, and those are Junction City and White City near Medford. The planning horizon that Sue Porter uses in her forecast of 10 years takes us out to about 2016. And so the final column for whatever the last sited city is that we would have to build in, we don't have any cost estimates because we don't really know what the population would be and exactly when that might be built.
This number is total of all these.
The next schedule is a compilation of the long-range construction plan, which provides a little more detail on the planned completion of construction and the planned occupancy of the various facilities. And it begins with the minimum facility for women at Coffee Creek. That completion is now scheduled for August of this year, and we would immediately occupy that after about a 30-day shakedown of the facility's systems. Next in line, sequentially, in terms of construction completion again, would be the Shutter Creek Correctional Facility in North Bend. We have been notified, however, that the City of Lakeside sewer expansion has been delayed by approximately a year. So the beds at the Shutter Creek facility will not be able to be utilized until about July of 2007. The Deer Ridge facility in Madras, the men's minimum, the plan there is for completion of let me just back up a little bit. This facility was initially scheduled for what we would call a double build, typically a minimum medium combination at a co-located facility would have a 400 or 432 bed minimum component. This one was scheduled to do a double build of the minimum unit in order to take advantage of some of the size there and delay the needed construction of the next facility to some degree. The October forecast produced by the Office of Economic Analysis did begin to show some leveling off of the growth rate in the population forecast. So we took a breath and looked at what the implications of that might be with respect to particularly the demand for minimum inmates, and looked at the needs in the department for treatment services, particularly alcohol and drug, and the mental health populations. We decided that we would pursue a downsizing of one of the minimum units for the purpose of creating some treatment beds, and the treatment practitioners recommend typically a minimum dorm size would be about 108 beds. That's too large for a productive treatment community, and so we downsized that second 432-bed facility to 212 beds, and it's comprised then of four 53-bed treatment units. The current plan would be to bring half of the, what I call the standard minimum, online September of 2007, following completion. Again, this is one that was delayed to some degree. The construction will be complete December of 06. We won't occupy that until September of 07. And so we'll have some issues there just in terms of fiscal plant, folks needing to go around and maintain the systems, flush the toilets, run the water, do those kinds of things that are necessary to keep an empty facility functional there and maintain the warranties. The 216-bed minimum unit that would open in September of 07 are basically the inmates that are necessary to maintain the facility, in particular outside the medium secure perimeter. The laundry is located outside the medium fence, and so we will have to have minimum inmates on site to do the laundry, the food service, and a number of those basic institutional care. That second 432-bed facility to 212 beds, and it's comprised then of four 53-bed treatment units. The current plan would be to bring half of the, what I call the standard minimum, online September of 2007, following completion. Again, this is one that was delayed to some degree. The construction will be complete December of 06. We won't occupy that until September of 07. And so we'll have some issues there just in terms of fiscal plant, folks needing to go around and maintain the systems, flush the toilets, run the water, do those kinds of things that are necessary to keep an empty facility functional there and maintain the warranties. The 216-bed minimum unit that would open in September of 07 are basically the inmates that are necessary to maintain the facility, in particular outside the medium secure perimeter. The laundry is located outside the medium fence, and so we will have to have minimum inmates on site to do the laundry, the food service, and a number of those basic institutional care jobs. The current plan is for the first set of treatment beds, and these would be, at this point in time, the department's recommending mental health treatment beds to be open in November of 07. Two of those 53-bed units would open, and they would immediately relieve that same number of beds in medium custody facilities elsewhere in the department. We currently don't have any mental health treatment capacity for men in minimum facilities. And so if you're a minimum inmate and you have a mental health need, you bump up into an override situation and occupy a medium custody bed. So that is creating some compression within the system for medium custody beds. The second set of treatment beds we're scheduling to open in June of 2008, and those will likely be addiction treatment beds that Ginger referred to earlier in her testimony. Next in line would be the completion of the two final medium custody units for women at the Coffee Creek facility. Those are scheduled to be completed in March of 07. And the first one of those would be occupied April 07. And the final one based again on the population forecast for women. We wouldn't need to open the final medium unit until about April of 2011. The Deer Ridge section in the center of your page there is probably the most complicated. In the past, based on the demand and the timing of construction, we've been able to open and operate most of the facilities fairly quickly, and so we gain the efficiencies of opening an entire building and system at one time. With the flatlining of the growth rate in the population, we'll have to stagger and delay the opening of the number of units for some time at the Deer Ridge facility. The department's philosophy has always been that we won't open facilities or units until they're absolutely necessary. And so you see that reflected in the staging then of all the various units at Deer Ridge. The first units that will open there will be the high custody units. These are the segregation and disciplinary units, and there is a serious demand in the department system for those beds at this point in time. Following that would be combinations of cell and dorm units. The dorm units would be used again to provide primarily assistance support, food service, jobs within the medium custody facility. And so we're trying to achieve the right mix of cells versus dorms to address population management needs there. The last item you see at the bottom of the page is our next facility, and it is again a combined co-located medium and minimum facility. We don't expect the construction of that to be completed until late in 2012. And so in the agency request budget for the 07-09 biennium, you will not see a request for construction of a new facility. But we will need to request about $10 million in planning and design money, and that process is likely to begin about mid-biennium in the probably the July 08 timeframe when we would need to begin the planning process for the next facility. Again, at the end of this page, there are some beds still left on the table beyond the current planning horizon. And again, my comment earlier, at this point, we don't have enough population data to project out beyond the 10-year horizon. And so we'll be updating this as each forecast comes along. On the back of your page is a chronological schedule that provides some overall budget information for the department. Just across the top, you have the biennium, the average daily population for each biennium. Just a quick comparison, a 10-year split on population change over the previous 10-year period. Total funding, that's the total department's budget, including all fund types. And again, a similar 10-year split on what the growth looks like in 10-year windows. There's a column that captures the general fund total budget. That's comprised of the column just immediately to the right, titled General Fund, and the two columns to the far right, labeled Debt Service General Fund and Community Grants General Fund. Also reflected in the middle of the section there are the other fund limitations and federal fund limitations that were approved for the department. At the far right is the average cost per day that the department has used, primarily in its characterization of the costs associated with security, housing, direct services, and it does not include any of the central administrative or support costs, such as payroll or accounting or the budget office or human resources. Our attempt there is to come up with a rate that reflects the cost of direct care. And the final column to the far right indicates the change in the average daily cost over the previous biennium. A couple of just comments to note as you look down through this, in particular in the other funds column in the very center, you'll note as we get down into the 1995-97 period and subsequent to that, there is a significant variation in a number of biennia. This is the fund type that captures the construction limitation and any debt service that we would pay using balances from previous sales. So there is a significant swing in a number of those biennia. Also, just a reminder for those of you that were involved in the 2003-05 budget period, there was a $116 million federal block grant that was designated for use by the department. There's a fund shift that occurs between the general fund and federal funds.
21 to 4.
So, All this to say, as you can see, there is significant growth. The growth in the budget generally follows pretty consistently on a straight line. I didn't bring a graph to show it. But it generally tracks very closely on a parallel line and slope with the population forecast, which should not be surprising. Just ask for, some direction from the committee chairs. Would you like to do questions on each section? Would you like me to finish the entire conversation and then come back?
I think we'll do questions on each section here. I think that would be most efficient. Are there questions from the committee on this, Representative Pearson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure I understand that the average daily cost number and how it relates to the capital construction. And I don't, forgive me, I'm not quick enough with these numbers here to be able to figure out whether the capital construction costs of new facilities is included in the daily cost.
It is not. I'm sorry. Chairs, Representative, the cost of construction and the cost of a number of one-time costs are excluded from that calculation. For example, a new facility has a certain amount of startup, what we call startup expense, new equipment, new items that are necessarily to outfit the facility. Those items are taken out of this equation, so there's a more comparable apples-to-apples from period-to-period analysis there.
Is there a number that would make sense that would reflect the cost of operating the system given the expansions? That is, can we say there's a daily cost or an annual cost for incarceration that includes the capital construction cost of building these new facilities that we're bringing online? And I realize that would require an amortization of the useful life of that facility.
I'm chair, members of the committee, we have not attempted to do that. There has been an interest in developing a number of differing models for cost per day. There are some states who use a more comprehensive model that would include all of the central support, all of the administration. And some do, in fact, use all of their capitalization costs, their interest financing, all of those total cost numbers. And in a number of national publications, those differences in the models or applications of the cost elements has been the source of a number of questions. Why is Oregon at 64 versus some states that are at 123? That kind of question has come, but we have not developed a model that's that inclusive yet.
But are you able, if I can expand on your question, are you able to at least incorporate the overhead costs, you know, the administrative costs, the HR costs, the into the $67.53? What would that number be with those centralized costs?
We have done that for, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. We have done that for purposes of comparability to some of the community corrections, county costs. And so that does exist. I didn't bring that today. I would, if I could remember correctly, it would be something in the neighborhood of the mid-80s, $85 to $88, something in that range, if you were going to include all of the operating costs for the department, excluding the debt service, though, and the cost of the construction pieces.
Did you follow up, Representative McPherson?
No, that's all for now, Madam Chair.
I did have a question when I saw the general fund total on this second chart, on the back of the second chart that you were talking about, $1,037 million. Okay, I flunked math. It's out now. I'm just wondering if you have statistics showing what percentage of the general fund over a period of years the corrections budget has been.
The percentage of the total general fund.
Do you have a percentage? You have a change in the previous 10 years, but do you have... Well, let me ask you about that column, the percent general fund change previous 10 years, okay, 1991 to 93, so that 199% change, and that would be since 81, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so if you go down to 2005-2007, it's 67% more than 1995-97.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
It'd be interesting to have the figure of what percentage of the general fund the correction budget has represented for particular years. Because I know that there has been a flip. It used to be
right.
Higher education had a bigger percentage, and now corrections has a bigger percentage than higher education.
Madam Chair, we do have that schedule. I didn't bring it today, but I'd be happy to provide that.
If you could provide that for our record, that would be very helpful. Senator
Whitsitt. Thank you, Mr. Burdick. Two questions, actually. One regarding the percentage change over the prior biennium on the average cost per day of incarceration. It appears that from 1997 through 2005-2007 biennium, there's been about a 5% per year median increase, or 5% per biennium median increase, but the range there is from a plus 14 to a minus 4, which would be three times above the median to two times below the median. Could you explain to us why there's such a variation in the change in from one biennium to the next in the cost of incarceration?
Madam Chair and Senator, I wish I could. It's a very detailed calculation. I'd be happy to go back and backtrack through some of the calculations. I can answer a part of your question with respect at least to the 2001-03 biennium where the negative 4% appears. That was a significant period of time for the state in terms of budget reductions. And so we, like many other states, went through a budget reduction exercise that diminished the resources. And so there was a natural mathematical calculation of where that overall budget was reduced, and it produced a reduction in the average daily population. The one that I am less clear about is the 14% that occurred between the 95-97 and the 97-99 period, but I'd be happy to do some more research and compare those components.
Thank you. And another question was regarding, you spoke of some delays in construction. What I'm particularly about the a year's delay due to the necessity for a sewer hookup or whatever. I wonder if you could quantify the cost to the state of such a delay, both in terms of the not being able to utilize those beds for a year, and also in the time value of the money already invested that is sitting there.
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't know exactly how to answer the question. I know that at the present time, given the flattening again of the leveling of the forecast for the minimum population, the beds are not needed at this point in time, so the delay doesn't really cause us a push elsewhere in the system or a need to accelerate anything else. We could certainly calculate the value of the investment and the delay of using it, but in terms of translating that into perhaps the cost of needing to rent beds, an equivalent number of beds, we could do that, certainly. I'm not sure that answers your question.
Thank you. Why don't you move on to your next
question?
Oops.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. You talk about a delay in opening facilities. Is there any surrounding states that have under capacity that if that facility was able to open, we can actually rent those beds out to other states?
Madam Chairman, Representative Cameron, I'm not aware of any states that have inquired about using existing capacity. At the present time, we are full. And so that's probably one of the reasons why there hasn't been the inquiry. But I guess it does open up the conversation if we were to continue on the construction schedule and the forecast were to change and actually take a downturn in a way that would free up existing capacity. And if it were a sustainable trend, it would be something that we would probably expect to see more inquiries about.
Thank you.
But we have not received anything today.
I just had a quick question here on the Coffee Creek construction plans. There's been quite a dramatic increase in ID theft, and the percentage of women involved in that particular crime is very high. Are you watching that pretty carefully? I mean, the assumption is it's going to level out. If it doesn't level out as predicted, what impact is that going to have?
Madam Chair, the situation at Coffee Creek with respect to women is an area of concern for us, given that growth in the population forecast. At this point in time, that facility is full. We're actually renting about 23 beds from one of the counties in the state. These three units that we are currently constructing will be the last three units that are within the siting authority at that location. What we're beginning to explore more seriously is the shift of the intake center, which is about a 400-bed facility there for men, and that process, converting that to another women's unit and then relocating that intake center somewhere else within the system. That conversation is just beginning, so I don't have any indication of where that might go, but that is our constraint.
All right. Senator Whippet.
Actually, I was pointing out Mr. Taylor to you.
Oh, you were? Okay, Mr. Taylor.
Are we currently running any beds out of state right now?
Madam Chair and Mr. Taylor, we are not currently, and actually don't have the authority to at this point in time.
Okay, McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to track with the forecast numbers and how they correspond to the capacity numbers I see on this chart. It appears to me that upon completion of Madras, which is, according to this spreadsheet, shows it is in 2008, we'll have a total capacity in the system of 14,844 inmates. And the projection of prison population that we were shown earlier, and I realize this changes over time, but it would show a capacity or a projected population of somewhat less than that, in the low 14,000s. And that's before this new medium and minimum level security facilities that are in Junction City or White City. So I guess the question I would raise is, are we on a trajectory which, if we believe the projection numbers that we now have, would give us an overcapacity within the next 5, 6, 7 years.
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, we very closely design the construction schedule and in particular the occupancy schedule to match the forecast, and so we would certainly hope that event doesn't occur, and we would plan for it not to occur. The reality is, though, that we have to construct the facilities as a project, and given the size of these, as you saw on the second schedule, there will often be, in this environment, especially with a flattening trajectory on the population forecast, we'll have more occupancy or more vacancies in the newly constructed facilities as they are filled up over longer periods of time. So where the capacity issues goes in big steps, the population forecast is a more gradual slope and fills up to that point. When it reaches that break-even point, that's the point when the new construction needs to be available for the next several years' worth of growth.
A follow-up, if I could, which is to raise a policy question, and this may go beyond the scope of what your responsibilities are. Do you think the best policy for us to adopt, is it to make sure that we have sufficient capacity for the likely or possible population projections, or is it better to maybe be at or a little below that so that we don't run the risk of having overbuilt and having wasted space or the costs to the state of having built capacity that's not necessary?
Not sure, Representative, that truly is a policy question. I guess the question really is one of balancing the population management needs and the fiscal needs of the state with respect to budgets, but I guess my hope would be that we are approved in all the deliberation.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll move on now. Thank you.
Okay. The next set of information that, that you have in front of you deals with the demographic population analysis by age.
The information that the already in our research office has provided in.
Unfortunately, we did not have the tools to do a projection out into future periods for the age ranges, but in talking with Sue Porter, she indicates that, that she believes her forecast methodology can help us do that in the future, so we'll be happy to work with her and provide whatever we come up with at a later date. The age ranges that are listed are 18 and below. You can see a declining presence of that age range. 18 to 24 over the 2000 to 2006 time period, you see a significant change in that population. 25 to 30, a 50% increase over the six-year period. 31 to 45, a 28% growth rate. 46 to 60, an increase of 71%. And the inmates 60 and older, actually over 60, 109% growth rate over that six-year period. Overall, the population has grown the 37%. You can see at the bottom in the total line. And so, obviously, those two age groups of the older inmates are growing at a disproportionate rate. We also were interested to see what the mix or the relative share of the different age brackets represented within a given calendar year. As you can see at the very bottom, those 60 and older are not only growing at a significant rate in just raw numbers, but their representation within the total population is also growing by about 53%. We don't actually track a lot of information about the different population splits in terms of ages. Older inmates are housed in general population. They're given some consideration to physical capabilities. They're often assigned lower bunks. But in general, their placement in the population is subject to the same process as any other inmate. Vulnerabilities, programming needs, health needs, all of those criteria are considered, but by and large, they're housed within the general population. We were able to acquire some information with respect to healthcare costs from our managed care provider, ODS, and the next slide looks at a three-year snapshot of these would be off-site claims where an inmate has to be treated in a local clinic or hospital or doctor's office for a medical condition. Three different brackets there. The average claim, inmates over 60, and then a percentage comparison to the inmates that are 18 to 54. Between 2003 and 2005, the cost for an off-site visit, the average cost, is about 2.5 times what it was in 2003. Inmates over 55, and this bracket includes those in the 60 and older bracket. So it's a comprehensive, inclusive thing. And the reason we did the two different brackets there was just to give you some indication of what the push is as you go up another 5 years. The average, for example, in 2003 for all inmates over 55 was the 8,053. If you just isolate those over 60, then that average incident or claim cost goes up to 9,193. We have also asked the ODS folks to give us some total cost information that was used to develop these averages, so we'll have some incident counts and total cost information that we'd be happy to share with you if you have an interest in that as well. that's all I have for the age issue in terms of what's happening with the cost information for the elderly population.
Let me just ask you a clarifying question on this. The average claim in age over 60, that 120%, that means that the 9,193 is 120% of what?
Madam Chair, it's 120% of the average claim cost of an inmate between 18 and 55, the bottom number in that same
18
column.
18 and 54, okay.
18 and 54, right. Yes, thank you.
Okay, so the 11,156% higher than the 4,502, but like my math is not good, but that seems like it's understating it. I mean, that's almost triple.
It's measuring, Madam Chair, it's measuring the difference between the two. So the difference between the 11,517 and the 4,502 is about 7,000. And that difference of 7,000 is roughly 156% of the base number or the 4,502. So it's measuring the change between the two rather than the absolute value.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification. Questions from the committee? Can I ask another follow-up question on the inmates over 60? I know this is really hard to quantify, but how dangerous are these people given their age and their infirmities that are shown in these medical statistics?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that.
Do you have any way of measuring, like, how many of them are wheelchair-bound, how many of them are disabled to the extent that they can't function?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if we have that kind of detailed information in our inmate database, but I'd be happy to ask Dr. Belletti and find out if we have that.
Okay, that would be helpful to find out. Because you know, these are obviously very, very high-cost people, and if they're so disabled that they can't be a danger to society, then there would be policy implications, obviously.
Correct. And Madam Chair, I also have an interest in pursuing this a little bit further to get some better understanding of what accounts for the growth within the different age ranges. For example, does the growth in the 60, over 60 population result from just length of sentence, or is this a growth that's a function of new crimes or new intakes, and to get some better understanding of what's driving the
understating it. I mean, that's almost triple.
It's measuring, Madam Chair, it's measuring the difference between the two. So the difference between the 11,517 and the 4,502 is about 7,000. And that difference of 7,000 is roughly 156% of the base number or the 4,502. So it's measuring the change between the two rather than the absolute value.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification. Questions from the committee? Can I ask another follow-up question on the inmates over 60? I know this is really hard to quantify, but how dangerous are these people given their age and their infirmities that are shown in these medical statistics?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that.
Do you have any way of measuring, like, how many of them are wheelchair-bound, how many of them are disabled to the extent that they can't function?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if we have that kind of detailed information in our inmate database, but I'd be happy to ask Dr. Belletti and find out if we have that.
Okay, that would be helpful to find out, because you know, these are obviously very, very high-cost people, and if they're so disabled that they can't be a danger to society, then there would be policy implications, obviously.
Correct. And Madam Chair, I also have an interest in pursuing this a little bit further to get some better understanding of what accounts for the growth within the different age ranges, for example, does the growth in the 60, over 60 population result from just length of sentence, or is this a growth that's a function of new crimes or new intakes, and to get some better understanding of what's driving the increases within the different age ranges. So,
yeah, very helpful as well. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Each comment spins out more questions. As to the portion of the population that is over 65, if they're incarcerated, does Medicare provide any of that cost, or because they're incarcerated, is that a DOC cost?
Madam Chair and Representative, it is a DOC cost. Those benefits available to the general public and general population are not available to DOC.
And my follow-up would be, has there been any exploration of what it would take to access Medicare funds for the population that's incarcerated is over 65?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer, but I'll find it out for you.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting to know.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is that it for your...
I do have a little, Madam Chair, I do have a little information on the medical or the mental health population.
I'll step there.
And I do appreciate the comment. This is a pretty high flyover, and so as questions arise, as you have a chance to look through this in more detail, I'd be happy to research whatever I can for you. The slides that start this, the pages that are here, are, I think, part of a presentation that Director Williams made to the committee back in February, and so some of this may be familiar to you. We do know that approximately 20% of all the DOC inmates have some severe or high mental illness treatment need, and that increase has been showing up since about 1999, where it was about a 12% rate. 3,600 inmates basically within the system at any time are in need of some level of mental health care. The next slide shows again sort of a recap in the population growth. And if the 20% rate in fact does hold, there's an expectation that by 2016 we could have somewhere in the 3,200 range of inmates who need some kind of, or who have some severe mental health need. The pie chart, again, I think was provided earlier as well, but it does show the splits within the different classifications of need that our mental health staff are tracking. About 60% of the population has no need. Another 14% would benefit from some treatment. 6% have what's classified as a moderate need. And then the 20% in the upper range of severe and highest need are shown there as well. So it's a pretty significant percentage of the population. You had asked about the cost of care. This is a difficult one for us because of the range of locations of the different inmates, the different levels of service, ranging from special management units, which is an intensive hospital level of care. There are program treatment situations where contracts are in place to provide group treatment, residential treatment programs. So there's an array of treatments being provided, and so trying to narrow that down to a particular cost per day is a little difficult. But what they've provided us with is this: the mental health treatment in general population, in addition to the $67.53, which is the average daily cost, you would add about $1.14 a day for someone with a moderate treatment need. That increases to $268 per day above the standard base cost per day for someone with a severe mental health need. And for someone with a high mental health need, this is not necessarily someone who's in the special management unit, but somebody who has a high level of demand for service, it could go as high as about $10 a day beyond the standard base cost per day. This is the next slide. For folks that are housed in the special management unit, which is the hospital level intensive care, the treatment costs for those services go almost $57 a day beyond the standard cost per day rate. And in addition to that, because of the extensive supervision that's required and the security staffing that's required in that unit, it adds about $70 a day based on the staffing component. The next slide, again, since we have reorganized in the 2004 biennium, prior to that period of time, the mental health program and the alcohol and drug programs were combined into a counseling and treatment services unit. What I have readily available is a brief history of the mental health budget as a whole program within the department. You can see the growth there. The staffing on this program has remained relatively constant, again, largely because most of the residential programs and the treatment are provided by contractors. This slide shows, again, the growth rates over time for the dollars themselves, for the positions in FTE, and then shows the relative investment in this program as a percentage of the total Department of Corrections budget, which, as you can see, has remained fairly constant as well. The next slide is a picture of those populations within the department's population that have severe and highest need. And these are snapshots of the populations as of January 1st of each of the years that are listed. And again, you can see significant growth between 2000 and 2006 in both those categories. And at the bottom, the categories individually as a percentage of the total, again, we're trying to see where the push is with respect to the distinctions between severe and highest. You see a slight increase in the proportion of highest need relative to the severe, going from 36 to 39.7. So clearly we have a growing population with a growing need, and as Ginger Martin mentioned earlier, our response to that has been to begin to consider in the new construction programs developing housing environments that can accommodate treatment programs to deal with the increase in this need. I've also attached, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, but I just attached for your interest a comparison between the staffing plans for security staff between the special management unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary and a general population unit, which theoretically could be anywhere in the department. Obviously, there's a difference in the number of inmates that are housed in each of those, and so at the bottom of each of the columns, we have biennialized that in a cost per inmate served number, so you get a better comparison of the overall cost per bed. But the numbers are significant there, and you can see those, and just as a point of information. And that concludes the mental health presentation.
Let me just ask another question on your methodology for computing these costs. Obviously, the costs are very much higher for the more intensive treatment necessary for some of these severely mentally ill people. The average cost is 67.53. When you compute that average, does that average include these higher costs per inmate? Per mentally ill inmate, does that include it?
Madam Chair, yes it does, in that it includes the 6753 includes all of the department's investment in all of the programs that deliver services directly to inmates. That's correct.
Have you figured out what that number if you subtracted the intensive costs of the mentally ill, what that would do to that average number?
Madam Chair, we have not.
It might be kind of interesting to see the impact on the overall average cost of the system.
We'll take a look at that.
Okay. Question to the committee. Senator, Representative Whitnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll repeat that three times here.
Mr. Allen, I'm not sure if this is your area of expertise. In the past, on the committees I've been involved in, we've been concerned about when a inmate gets out and he's been on medication for mental health problems, and being sure we cover that gap before he can get on Oregon Health Plan. Have we solved that issue so the inmate stays on his medications?
Madam Chair, Representative, I know there is a significant effort that's ongoing toward that problem. I'm not sure how it's been resolved or if it has, but be happy to find out and report back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's, we talked about how that, all the work we've done with them, if they come out and don't have their medications, then all that work.
Ginger may have the answer for you on that.
Ginger Martin, Assistant Director, Department of Corrections. I don't know if I have the answer, but I have some parts of an answer. Two bits of progress. We do send inmates out of prison with a 30-day medication supply for those who are seriously mentally ill. That's oftentimes not quite sufficient to get them completely connected with services locally, but it's a step in the right direction. And we've recently assigned a mental health counselor to work with the very high-need cases that really do require some pretty close, you know, hand-to-hand service inside to service outside kind of coordination. The other thing that's happening is some work with between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services to create a process to pre-qualify people who may be eligible for federal benefits by virtue of their disability caused by their mental illness. And we are putting into place those processes, building on a process that actually Multnomah County started last biennium. So that will also provide a very good safety net so that people who are seriously mentally ill and disabled will have their federal benefits in place, including their health benefits, when they leave the prison. So we're very close to getting that process working properly everywhere, and it is certainly working very well in some places.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as I think we keep it on the radar scope, and I'm sure it sounds like we are.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. On the percentages, 1999, 12% roughly were mentally impaired, 20% today. And then you make the assumption that it'll be 20% in 2016. But the rate of change from 1999 to now is about 65%. If you carry that same rate of change through until the year 2016, you would actually have almost 34% of your people incarcerated would be mentally ill. So why did you make that assumption that the rate of change would not increase?
Madam Chair and Senator, this is actually not my data, and so I'm going to apologize for not having a very good answer. The rate of change is always an issue of concern, and the ability to predict the mixes of populations and needs is a challenge for us. There's no question about that. This is another area where I'd like to entertain some conversation with the Department of Administrative Services to talk about whether or not there's a way to dissect or use the forecast model to step down a level and look at the particular demographic elements to see if we can put a finer point on some of these, because this area in particular, if we're going to be responsive to the need, we're going to have to be able to have better data that can integrate into the planning process that enables us to say, we have enough mental health treatment beds or we don't. How many do we need? How long will we need them? Is it a backlog issue or is it an ongoing forever kind of issue that will continue to grow? But we'll take a look at that rate and see if that's really a usable rate for us.
Madam Chair, with that, with the methamphetamine problems we have and the mental illness that is related to that, I would think that we really should look at that.
Representative Barker. Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to the people over 60, in recent years, juries have been reluctant to sentence somebody to death based on the fact that they can offer or are able to sentence them to life without the possibility of parole. The people who are over 60, how many would fall into that category where they're not going to get out ever?
I'm sure, Representative Barker, I don't know the answer to that. I'll find out, though. Over 60?
Yeah. I mean, my concern would be what I think that Chairman Burke was kind of pointing to, that people get older and they're not dangerous. Maybe we should get them out of the system, but if they're in there without possibility of parole, I think that would create a huge problem to then say, well, you're without the possibility of parole until you get older, and then you can go, you know. But I think we'd see more death sentences, which I don't think we want to. Thank you. I'd like to, if you could.
I will find out, yes.
It would be worth finding out the answers to these questions, because it's a very, very high cost proposition to keep the elderly in prison. And we just need to know what issues we're talking about. Okay. I see no more questions, so we will recess. And I'm going to have us come back at 1 o'clock, and let's make it as close to that as we can. We will be in recess until 1 o'clock. Thank you.
Call the Senate House Interim Committee on Judiciary back to order.
No, he was.
We're going to have a report on Senate Bill 919-2005.
Okay, thank you. Judge, are you there? Judge Karen. Thanks, Judge.
Go ahead, Mr. Clemens.
Thank you, Chair Krieger and Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, thanks for having us here. For the record, again, my name is Craig Prinz. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. Tom Leininger is going to try to join us. He's the Chair of the Commission. I know he had a class to teach at the University of Oregon, so I don't know if he made it. And then Anna Peterson is here, but she might still be finishing her sandwich. So wanted to thank you for inviting us. So I'm here, and we're here basically to talk about one of the charges that came through this committee last session, which is Senate Bill 919. And how the Criminal Justice Commission usually works on something like this is we'll try to find a good broad group of people that represent different interest groups, different areas in the criminal justice system. And we were fortunate enough to get former Chief Justice Carson here to chair the 919 group, which made my job a lot easier, and I wanted to thank him. And so I'm going to hand it off to him, but before I do, I'll just kind of give the framework of Senate Bill 919 asked us to do a certain study that the chief can explain. And I think where we are right now is the chief has broken that up into a couple work groups. And by the way, there's several members in the audience who are on those work groups. Judge Barron is on the telephone, and he is heading one of the work groups. Ginger Martin is heading the other one. Steve Dole is here. He's on both of the work groups.
Thank you.
So we have a good group of people to work with. But that's where we are right now, is we're working on this study that you've charged us. And the next step would be for the whole 919 advisory committee that Chair Leininger brought together. They'd have to approve any recommended changes. Then the Criminal Justice Commission would have to approve those changes. And Representative Olson and Chair Burdick are non-voting members of the commission. And then it would be coming before you next session. There's a good process of making sure that everything gets fully vetted as we look at this study. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Chief Carson.
Thank you. Do we have a copy of that?
Yes.
Chair, as a member of the committee, I'm Wally Carson. Recently deposed Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Yeah, it was pretty bloody, but I'm still on the court. The rules aren't necessary, but I will retire at the end of the year. The bill 919, I think probably they asked me to do it because I seem to have spent most of my adult life either deciding what the legislature ought to do or then trying to decide what the legislature did in my two careers. And so they wanted somebody that could enforce the statute. The charging language is whether it is this group, the CJC, and us, whether it is possible to incorporate consideration of reducing criminal conduct and the crime rate into the commission's sentencing guidelines, and if it is possible, the means for doing so. So our charge is to determine the possibility of sentencing guidelines being susceptible to improving them, if we, I think would be the rule, that will reduce criminal conduct and the crime rate. Now, most of us talk about when we turn to sentencing guidelines to putting in risk factors or risk assessment. And it's kind of tricky how you get there, but that's where we are now. And as Craig has said, the committee we anticipate will come together and each task forces or working groups will report and then we'll proceed. This is focusing on the sentencing guidelines, and most of this is contained in the written materials, but I'm trying to make it a little more interesting. The sentencing guidelines, I always am reminded that it helps the old sometimes. When I was younger, we had indeterminate sentencing. Class A was 20 years. And the parole board, most of you know this, parole board determined when a person got out. The judges had almost nothing to do with it. And then we had a chair of the parole board, I think he was a Unitarian minister from Portland, Blaylock, and he came up with what we now call the matrix system, crime history and criminal history and crime severity. And then that morphed into the sentencing guidelines, and you're all familiar with the sentencing guidelines that you have, and the CJC is responsible for setting them up. So that's basically what we have. One of the first things, and Mike Stafford, who's a very able staff member for CJC, mentioned it to me, that there was some concern, at least by one DA, that we might be monkeying around with ballot measure 11. One of the first things we determined as a committee was, in accordance with the charge here, working with the sentencing guidelines as our target, that immediately takes out misdemeanors and ballot measure 11, because neither one of those categories are involved in that. So you don't expect anything from us on changes to ballot measure 11 or misdemeanors. So he started out with reducing criminal conduct, and I say, this is partial and obvious propositions, I say that the way we do that, the second part is the crime rate. I think if you reduce criminal conduct, it's just a mathematical calculation that if the population continues to grow, if we are successful in reducing criminal conduct, then in fact the crime rate will go down. And that's our charge, our hope, our goal. So we're trying to get those two policy or strategies incorporated in the sentencing guidelines. One other point beyond the not ballot measure 11 is that we, because it's sentencing guidelines, it comes in half in the middle of the act. This is not a crime prevention study. This is not a juvenile delinquency study. It's what happens at the sentencing, and that means the person has already been committed a crime and been convicted. So we come in midstream, but there are several members of the group, and I think you have the list in our report of the fine people. I was delighted, what a wonderful group to be a part of. We're not working at the front end, we're working after it starts, after sentencing aspect, and we hope that we will be able to offer some assistance to judges with your help and with the help of the full committee and the CJC make some efforts to make the sentencing a little more helpful to reduce recidivism and therefore reduce the crime rate and also increase public safety. I think, without just going on that, the risk assessment is, there's one state, Virginia, that has started down the path. Nobody else has started it. We had the fellow who's in charge of it speak to us at one of our early meetings, and we still hope maybe he can come out this fall and assist us in focusing our program so we can present it and ultimately to you next session. I want to leave the door open for the fact that we very well may find that it's too much candy for the nickel, and we can't recommend that we make a change in the assessments. But we hope we can move toward what we want to have in the state of Oregon, and with your help, I think, I personally think we'll be able to do it, but that remains to be seen. Craig, maybe if you wanted to take over and do the two subgroups and introduce gender and RIT.
Okay. So committees and chairs and committees, what we did is we started down this road of looking at what does a risk assessment look like. And so as we did that and then we looked at the guidelines themselves, we realized we had really two discrete things we would need to do. One would be to create a risk assessment tool that would make sense at the sentencing point. Chief Carson appointed Ginger to be the head of that because risk assessments, as she, I think, testified at Department of Corrections, are already used. They're used for a slightly different purpose, and Paul Bellotti, who built the ACRE system that Ginger could tell you about, is helping us to do one that you'd use for sentencing. And so in part of your... Ginger, maybe you could come up and part of your written work is the risk assessment data elements that Ginger can tell you about that Paul is working on. The other subgroup that Chief Carson had us broken up into is what we call the mechanics work group, and that is the one that Judge Barron, who's on the phone, is the chair of, and Steve is on and I'm on. And that's more of looking at the guidelines and saying to ourselves, okay, so you have a risk assessment. Would we need to change the guidelines to allow us to use it?
Thank you.
And I think the answer, Judge, are you hearing me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to keep talking, and then you interrupt if you want me to, but I think it's probably easier for me to explain it since you're on the phone. What we looked at was... Oregon has what's called a mandatory sentencing guideline system. That means that when a judge sentences someone, they must follow the box. And if they're going to depart up or down, they must give a stated reason. Some states have what's called an advisory system where it's just basically, it's still a legal sentence if the judge doesn't do that. But, you know, that's supposed to be the sentence. So our system is a mandatory system. The judge must follow it. And, of course, we have this case that some of you probably heard about a lot last session in the United States Supreme Court called Blakely. So the mechanics group has basically looked at different ways you'd want to, we would probably need to change the guidelines to be able to use the risk assessment. So, Ginger, would you, maybe what we could do is you could talk about the risk assessment and then we can talk about the... Okay. And I wanted to say, too, committee, that Tom Leininger, the chair of the Criminal Justice Commission, is here, too. So, Tom, we got started, but Tom basically sat down and was really helpful in getting Chief Carson involved in this, and I think that was really one of the biggest steps. No, not that. But one of the great things is being able to bring together people like the Chief. So I'm going to hand it off to Ginger to talk about the theory work group, is what we call it.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director, Department of Corrections. Our work group met to sort through all of the kind of known characteristics that offenders might have that have been correlated in the past with higher rates of reoffending. So we essentially looked through all of the various kinds of risk research and pulled out all of those characteristics and sorted through them to determine which of those particular characteristics could be known at sentencing and which currently exist as data in some form so that we could test that particular characteristic and find its strength in predicting the offense. So the committee did that first step work, and I'll share with you some of the correlates that we're going to be looking at. And then the next step is for the Department of Corrections Research Department to do some statistical analysis to kind of look at what of the...
talk and then you interrupt if you want me to, but I think it's probably easier to for me to explain it since you're on the phone. What we looked at was Oregon has what's called a mandatory sentencing guideline system. That means that when a judge sentences someone, they must follow the box, and if they're going to depart up or down, they must give a stated reason. Some states have what's called an advisory system where it's just basically, it's still a legal sentence if the judge doesn't do that, but, you know, that's supposed to be the sentence. So our system is a mandatory system, the judge must follow it. And of course we have this case that some of you probably heard about a lot last session in the United States Supreme Court called Blakely. So the mechanics group has basically looked at different ways you'd want to, we would probably need to change the guidelines to be able to use the risk assessment. So, Ginger, maybe what we could do is you could talk about the risk assessment and then we can talk about the... Okay. And I wanted to say, too, committee, that Tom Leininger, the chair of the Criminal Justice Commission, is here, too. So, Tom, we got started, but Tom basically sat down and was really helpful in getting Chief Carson involved in this, and I think that was really one of the biggest no, not that, but one of the great things is being able to bring together people like the Chief. So I'm going to hand it off to Ginger to talk about the theory work group is what we call it.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director, Department of Correction. Our work group met to sort through all of the kind of known characteristics that offenders might have that have been correlated in the past with higher rates of reoffending. So we essentially looked through all of the various kinds of risk research and pulled out all of those characteristics and sorted through them to determine which of those particular characteristics could be known at sentencing and which currently exist as data in some form so that we could test that particular characteristic and find its strength in predicting reoffense. So the committee did that first step work, and I'll share with you some of the correlates that we're going to be looking at. And then the next step is for the Department of Corrections Research Department to do some statistical analysis to kind of look at what of those characteristics that can be known and for which we have data now seem to predict best whether someone is likely to reoffend. So that's kind of where we're trying to get to. The correlates that we'll be looking into are adult history of arrest or probation, adult history of prior convictions, looking at rates of conviction, types, severity, and number. We also wanted to look at convictions for specific types of crimes to see if they are predictive, in particular drug crimes and sex crimes. We want to look at adult history of prior incarcerations. We have good data that exists on prison incarceration. We don't have that good of data with jail incarceration, so we may or may not be able to use that as a factor. We want to look at adult history of prison misconduct and of revocation. And then we had a whole host of characteristics that, again, we're looking at adults, but their juvenile history might be predictive. So we wanted to look at a number of characteristics that they might bring with them with a juvenile crime history. Things like arrest, how old were they when they first became involved in the juvenile justice system, if they ever have been. Probation, incarceration, prior incarcerations, similar to the information that we want to look at for their adult history. We want to look at alcohol and drug abuse if we can, if that data exists in the current database. Then there's some other more kind of demographic characteristics, marital status, level of education, employment history, age at the time of assessment, substance abuse history, gender, race, and period of time conviction-free. That's all data we know is available to us and can be analyzed. The notion of looking at interpersonal conflict, we know we don't have that data in a state data system. It may exist in the Multnomah County data warehouse, so we talked about perhaps doing some analysis just with the Multnomah County offenders, because likely if it's predictive for offenders on supervision in Multnomah County, it's predictive of offenders generally. So we may use that approach to test some of this information that we don't have at a state level. So that's kind of where our work group is.
And so the idea of the work group is to gather that information and see what is correlative, what characteristics you can say from looking at released offenders, they have these characteristics. Then we need to do a very important part, which is it acceptable as a policy to rely on some of those characteristics, which we are not at that point yet. We're still at the point of deciding statistically which ones make a difference. So that's that work group. And then Judge Barron is on the phone from the other work group, and really what that one did, you can see in your handout, you've got this is what this represents what the guidelines look like now. For those of you who haven't been on Judiciary Committee or haven't heard this spiel, basically, if you look at the dark line in the middle, everything above that, those numbers represent the months of prison, which are the presumptive sentence. Everything below that dark black line is probation sentences, and those are kind of the number of jail days a presumptive sentence could have. Then you'd go on probation. And so this is the current system. When we had our discussions about how you'd have to change the guidelines, this is on in your written testimony. There are basically five proposals, and we realized we wanted to focus on the ones that we thought either could work there was no way it was going to get approved by the legislature. We thought, well, we're not going to do that. We're not going to put forward something that we know is probably not viable. And so of the five proposals, we really are focusing on two. One would be represented in the second sentencing guideline in your packet, which says CS 4-9 proposal. And basically what that represents is, and Senator Burdick, this will sound familiar from the Blakely stuff, it's basically what we would be doing is making the boxes have a bigger band of months that the judge, then it would be lawful for them to use the risk assessment to choose where in the band of time it's appropriate. So you'd have a lower risk offender would be getting a lower time, and the high-risk offender would be getting a higher time. Long story short, with a mandatory system and the Blakely case, you kind of have to do it that way to make it be lawful. If you didn't, you'd have to present everything to the jury in a really cumbersome fashion. So basically, if you look at that proposal, you can see, if you compare it to the first one, you can just see that we changed the bandwidth of months so that there's more choice. I'll highlight probably the important bands are these ones where it says, remember with 1145, if you're sentenced to less than basically 13 months, you're not going to go to prison. You're going to do that time in local jail. And as I think you probably gathered, that's a much less structured. Each county has a... You have a color-coded one. Okay, good. So, for example, if you look at the grid, that would be 4A. Currently, it's 10 to 11 months. On the proposal, which is Appendix C, if you look at that same grid, it would be 10 to 14 months. Not a big difference. But what that means with 1145 is, if it's 10 months, he's going to stay in jail. He's never going to go to prison. If it's 14 months, he's going to do a prison term. So you can see that's the kind of little change to the grid blocks that allows for us to use something like a risk assessment. And so that was the proposal that we came forward with Judge Barron. The other proposal would be using the risk assessment basically for things like whether to do consecutive sentences or not, whether to waive someone from juvenile court, or even to look at it basically like an aggravating or mitigating factor on the guidelines. Right now, if you have what we call an aggravating or mitigating factor, which means you can go above or below the box, usually that's related to the victim If it was a vulnerable victim, if the amount of harm was more than normal. So the other thought would be to kind of add it to that, make it a way you could depart out of the box. So that's where we are on the two subgroups. And so I think what I'll do is see if there's any questions, and I think I've introduced everyone. You might have questions. We might have to do a little bit of a musical chairs, depending on who you want.
Senator Burdick, you had a question?
So if I understand it correctly, vis-a-vis Blakely, if you took the approach of having bigger parameters within the box, is it your presumption that you wouldn't have to do a Blakely finding on that?
That's correct.
But if you deviated from the box, so it was an upward departure, you'd have to institute the Blakely.
Well, that's a good point.
Provisions.
That's correct. I probably misspoke. You're right. Just like Blakely currently, if it's an aggravating or mitigating factor upward, if it's an aggravating factor, we have to go to the jury. Yes, expanding the boxes means that any sentence within there is a lawful sentence under Blakely, and without going to the jury is the way we've analyzed it.
And do you think that there's any risk that it might be determined that if it's broad enough within the box that it might, a court might determine that a Blakely finding would have to be made? Especially if you were making a finding by the judge that there was a higher risk factor.
Exactly.
Do you see any chance that the risk factor itself might eventually have to be subjected to a Blakely finding?
Senator Burdick, that's the hard thing with our guideline system is how far that Blakely is going to go. I actually ran into a couple of friends of mine I used to practice with in Multnomah County as a DA who are now at the appellate. I think they worked with Jennifer Lloyd that we worked with on Blakely, and I think what we might want to do is get an update on another update on how far the Blakely case is being applied by the courts, and we will be very, I could see in the next 6-7 months we could have a lot more clarity so that when we present this we'll have a better idea. So at this point it's hard. We're trying to avoid it, and that's the goal of focusing on this kind of tweak of the guidelines.
If I may.
Yep, Judge, go ahead.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. Blakely says you can't go above the statutory maximum, but they basically set a mandatory guideline system. The box that you have is a statutory maximum, and by increasing those boxes, that would become the statutory maximum. I don't think anybody can ever predict what the U.S. Supreme Court would do or our Supreme Court, but under what they've said now, it would appear that just expanding those guidelines would avoid the Blakely problem as long as the judges stayed within those expanded guidelines. So, I mean, I guess if, even though you can't predict, it would be doubtful that they would go back and change it and say, okay, now you have to do something. Even if you used risk assessment in there, I don't think that would be much of a problem. And frankly, if the boxes were increased, it may be that not many judges would find many cases in which they would have to use Blakely to depart even further from what the expanded boxes say. Because you can see there's a big difference in the boxes between the current guidelines and the proposal under discussion now.
I guess, Judge, thank you for that clarification. I guess my concern is if you introduced risk factors that are in addition to the previous history and so on that goes into the sentencing guidelines, whether those risk factors would be seen as requiring a Blakely finding.
Chair Brody, Chair Speaker, members of the committee, it would be my position at least that would not, because generally that's what's introduced in an indeterminate sentencing proceeding now is all of those factors. And I'm also have been on the bench during that period of time, and pre-sentence reports, frankly, used to discuss many of those factors. And I don't think as long as you stay within those boxes, there might be some other rule of evidence or something, but I don't think Blakely would affect what you use within the statutory maximum, because that's what generally is talking about.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Ackerman?
I have a couple of concerns, and first is I think we're coming awfully close to Blakely, but we can argue that another day. The risk assessment things that were brought out here all seem to argue for an increase in the sanction or the sentence. That seems like it's skewed. Why not put good things in, like has the victim shown remorse, has he made restitution, da-da-da-da-da, on down the line? And I think from the point of a criminal defense lawyer defending a person, I would wonder how we would rebut these risk assessments. Because it seems to me you're saying, well, this is presumptively or conclusively correct. I don't think you can do that in a criminal proceeding, is to set forth a bunch of facts to say it's conclusive, we can't rebut it. You know, in death penalty cases, you do have a hearing after the conviction to determine by the jury whether a person should receive the death sentence, and you can bring in factors as to regarding rehabilitation and is he amenable to rehabilitation and all these sorts of social things that I think are important. I just don't think you can. I mean, I have a real problem, even if you could, in erecting such a system. It seems sort of skewed. But what about using race as a risk assessment? Isn't that racial profiling? I think you're coming close to a lot of very dangerous concepts here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Ackerman, let me take your first point of using race. I agree. I think we wanted to first gather data, and I could not foresee a situation where that would be one that we would decide as a policy level at the commission and then seek approval at the legislature that we would use. And Virginia doesn't use that, and they're really the in some ways the system that has had something like this in place for the longest time. The other thing that I would say, and actually the issues you brought up have been brought up by Peter Azan, who's on the 919 committee to some extent, and I agree with them, and I think that when I look at it, all the risk assessment can do is talk about the general population, not about an individual offender and whether they're going to commit new crimes. And so I think that as lawyers learn the limitations, what I see it as is if we compare it to what we have now, which is not really a risk assessment, but more of a, you know, when looking at just person felonies or non-person felonies, we're trying to just get, rather than just having common wisdom about who's a higher risk or not, which I know, you know, I've engaged in those hearing debates too, whether someone is going to reoffend or not. At least we have something that's statistically derived, and that is kind of the focus I see. But I think, so both of those points have been brought out, and I think that there'll be a lot more discussion about those.
Hey, may I add something?
Yes, go ahead.
And I think I was Representative Backman that asked the question. I think the first part of your question somewhat addressed why aren't there some positive things in here. And frankly, the theory of Appendix A does talk about things that obviously can be beneficial, marital status, level of education, employment history. Those things can certainly be very positive for someone. In addition to that, Blakely has really talked about going higher on a sentencing and not lower. And so at sentencing, even if you had these things, there would be nothing that would prevent the defendant from presenting a vast variety of information about himself, about his case, that would be in a positive way, and a judge, in listening to that, would obviously on the guidelines have the ability to depart downward and give a
or lesser spent. So I think, although there's a concern there, I think there are two ways of counteracting that. One is with the, frankly, the things that can bring out good things, and then the other thing is, frankly, the defendant's ability to bring out anything that he or she wishes to do.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, my name is Tom Leininger, and first of all, I'm sorry I was late. I had to teach at the U of O. I was actually teaching Representative Barnhart's son at the law school. In response to Representative Ackerman's second point, I think it's a very valid concern that legislation should not enable reliance on impermissible considerations. I wanted to point out the possibility that some jurisdictions, including the federal government, have listed prohibited considerations. And one such consideration might be race, national origin, perhaps religion. And so in making a list of circumstances that there are permissible bases for a deviation or for a place in the range, we might also consider listing some off-limits considerations, and I think that combination would be a valuable step forward whether or not you enlarge the range. I think that's an important benefit we could give judges, the benefit of the national experience in identifying what circumstances do determine whether people reoffend or not. So I think the fact that there are some circumstances on this list that scholars have found may correlate certainly doesn't mean we need to make those a cognizable basis for a different sentence.
Well, I still think you've got some, I'll just state just for the record, I think implicit in my first comments was the use of this material and the inability of the defendant to cross-examine on these criteria, I think is fundamental in my mind. I also think that such testimony in a trial, where you try to introduce statistics as the general population, you try to apply that to the individual defendant would be objectionable. And I think it would be objectionable during the trial phase to determine guilt. It should be objectionable to the sentencing phase to determine sentence or sanction. So I just think I'm just raising these issues for consideration. These are my gut reactions just thinking about it from a standpoint of a criminal defense lawyer. Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the point that the proposal in respect to the sentencing guidelines establish broader bans for each of the offenses, but it does look to me it's quite clear that that was achieved by moving the upper end up and not by, in any case, moving the lower end down. In fact, the only changes in the lower end are two cases in which, only two instances in which there was 1 month added. And so my question is, that given the charge of the task force that they're to study consideration of reducing criminal conduct and crime rate, is the question is adding extra potential time that a judge can in his or her discretion include in a sentence, is there evidence that the task force has or the commission has looked at that indicates that that will positively affect the criminal conduct or the crime rate?
Chairs and Representative McPherson, part of it was pragmatism in that when you look at we only looked at things above the dispositional line, so we were only looking at the boxes that were prison terms. And so most of those boxes, if you look at it, we started at the lower end, but you're right, we removed the gap between the boxes, basically, so that the end result would be the possibility for more months in most situations. To my mind, that was with two things in mind, which are the Blakely case, which prohibit moving up, but allow you to go down. You know, Blakely only applies if you're trying to make it a longer sentence. No defendant is saying that they had, you know, that the only problem with they want it presented to a jury if it goes down. So that's part of it. And the other part, to my mind, is the 1145 issue, where a lot of the sentences that we had at the bottom, so the ones that are at the adjacent to that dispositional line, really amount to local jail sentences now, and so I thought that the because the original intent were that those were supposed to be prison sentences, I thought it made sense to start so that you could have it be a prison sentence. But Representative McPherson, that is one of my concerns too, is after we figure out if you could do this, we would need to figure out what would the possible prison bed impact be and whether it's prudent, and I think that's something that we would have to do as part of the as part of bringing it to you. But as Sue Porter mentioned, trying to quantify the effect of the Blakely case in prison beds has been part of what the forecast committee tried to do, and I don't know that we have a good grasp on it, but this was my thought of kind of getting it back to where those boxes would be prison boxes at the adjacent to that dispositional line. But I'm very cognizant of that issue too, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything further?
That's it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Are you completely done informing us?
Yes.
It's good. Actually, been early.
Wow.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I guess the next meeting will be in September. Cassie, is it September 26th, I believe?
20th.
At that time, we'll start hearing more from reports and work groups that are reporting back to us. I think we're also going to hear in Blakely. Report on that on the agenda. But for example, you'll be hearing from Representative Ackerman and Senator Przanski on the work group and the council and court procedures. So that's what we'll be switching to. And do introduction too.
If nothing further, then we're adjourned. Thank you.
You're welcome.